Okay, so let's start. Everybody's turned in the homework? Okay, I'm going to go over Josh's solution to the homework, and I've already started to wonder. And I'll put a little color commentary about how I might have done the homework in this as well. I would have cut some corners on Josh here, so we can see whether he would have graded me down. Okay, problem number one, show that A mod M plus B mod M, and again, here it doesn't matter whether M is prime or anything, is equal to A plus B mod M, and also show that A mod M times B, that whole thing mod M, is equal to A times B mod M. So that was the first problem. We'll go over Josh's answer here first. Oh, Josh, it's really okay. R1 equals A mod M, which means R1 is a number less than M. R2 is equal to A plus B mod M. And R3 equals A mod M plus B mod M. And our task is to show that R2 is equal to R3. So because of the Euclidean algorithm, A equals Q1 M plus R1. And R1, again, is a number less than M. And A plus B equals Q2 M plus R2, which is and finally A mod M plus B is equal to Q3 M plus R3. So Josh makes some does some algebra. He says A plus B minus Q2 M, basically just did a substitution there. And then for A mod M, he substitutes R1. I guess I can write on this, huh? I guess yellow would be good here. So he substitutes here. He associates terms and uses the nice distributive law in solving for R2.R3. And then he looks at it and says, the thing on the right has to be less than M in absolute value. And I've got a positive, I've got something multiplying M. So unless it's zero, this is going to be wrong. So that thing in the front has to be zero. And he gets, therefore, R2 is exactly equal to R3, which is a nice complete solution. I just want to, go to the whiteboard.
Yes? To be fair, I didn't pull those equations out of thin air. Right? Those are the three mods that were in the original problem.
Yeah, yes.
Substituting what was there. So
this will be a test case to see if you would have graded me down.
Okay.
So I would have said A is equal to MQA plus RA, and then I would have said B equals MQB plus RB by the Euclidean algorithm. And then I would have looked at the two expressions. I would have said A mod M plus B mod M. And what I would have said, look, A mod M, according to this, is RA. And B is MQA plus RA. Oops. Or B, sorry. I meant B. 2 points off for that. And if I'd taken that mod M, since there's a multiple of M, it's equal mod M to this, right? RA plus RB. Sorry. This is I'm better at the board, but I guess we're going to have to learn. On the other hand, A plus B, maybe if I write bigger, mod M, is RA plus MQA plus RB plus MQB. And then when I add them all together, I get RA plus RB. And again, I'm going to factor out the nice M here. QA plus QB. This is, again, mod M. I'm running out of room. But again, if you have something mod M and you have a multiple here, you can throw this away. So this also is equal to RA plus RB mod M. And I guess I would just appeal to the fact that addition mod M is well-defined. So that these, since these two are equal, and whatever it is, mod M is a number less than M, you're okay.
Question.
Yeah.
Actually, I put something like this one too, but the problem is, how do you know you can distribute the mod across the pluses? Is that a given? I couldn't find
it. Well, I didn't actually distribute it. I got a number at the end.
Yeah, but you're essentially...
I didn't really use the distributive law. A plus B, or RA plus RB, is a number all by itself, and it's not like I'm adding those two numbers, and then I'm taking mod M.
You're making the M times QA plus QB go away because you're just simply saying, oh, I'm going to mod M across the whole...
No, I didn't do that. But which column, are you left column or right?
You're essentially saying that either way, you're doing a distribution across, or it looks like you're distributively...
Nope. So I don't think I did. What I said is...
you're missing a set of parentheses, but I'll
do that. Oh, yeah, I might be missing. I said A mod M... Since A is M, QA, you can't see me pointing, I have to actually point this way. Since A is M times QA plus RA, I substituted, when I take mod M, I actually just substitute RA. So I didn't distribute.
I'm with that. It's the next line down where you say
this
RA
one?
Plus MQ sub B plus R sub B.
Okay, so what
M.
I did was, I skipped a step, and my step I would have skipped was this. RA plus RB plus... M QB, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now the whole thing is mod M. And if the mod operator, if you have a multiple of M, you throw it away.
Yeah.
So it's not distributing. It's the definition of mod. I guess the definition of mod is the equivalence class of things which differ by a multiple of M.
I believe you, and I did it that way. I just still don't see the definition of. I mean, I understand it's like any multiple of m times some other value is going to go to zero.
It's
an integer is going to zero. I know that, but I just never really found a definition. I made me happy that I could go ahead.
So again, Josh's answer was more complete, but I think if you go back to what makes addition mod m well defined, because you can add, let's say we say mod 5. 5 plus 7 is well-defined mod 5, so it better come out to the same thing as 2 plus 2 mod 5.
I'm with you. This is what I did, but okay. I wasn't happy with it.
So. Well, I know Josh will decide whether you get full credit there, right?
Well, I'm biting my lip a little bit, but I might take off a point or two here, because I think I would suggest that canceling out the factor of M is basically what you're trying to show that you can do is distribute that mod M inside the sub.
Yeah.
So I was trying to be very pedantic, excessively pedantic, I agree, and avoid that. But there are many ways to solve this, there's no question.
Okay.
There is one other point, though. The assignment does not say that R is in the range from 0 to M. And infinitely many values of R will satisfy.
Yeah, I think basically any definition of mod or it has to talk about the equivalence classes if it's defined over all the integers. But the convention is that if you talk about something mod m, it's the least positive remainder after dividing by m.
If I didn't include that in the definition, that's my error.
One point off.
So are we saying that he will mark off a solution that you yourself would have been...
We're not doing that.
Okay.
We're not doing that game. Okay.
Now you get to attack me for the grading, so...
Yeah.
Okay.
And then...
On that page, wait, the page that slide you just were on.
Whoops, where'd it go? There we go.
How do you know that BQ1 minus Q2 plus Q3 equals 0?
BQ1 times Q3...
No, minus Q2 plus
this
Q3.
Right here, this thing.
Yeah, how do you know that equals 0?
I'm skipping to the N, but what he says is the thing on the left-hand side of this equation is less than M in absolute value, right? Mm-hmm. So I have something, some integer, some positive integer, multiplied by M, which is less than M. Oh, sorry, some non-negative integer multiplied by M is less than M. And there's only one non-negative integer, which when you multiply it by m is less than m, and that's 0. So.
Question, is it possible that bq1 minus q2 plus q3 is less than 0?
Believe where Josh has probably taken care of the case and made, I don't know, see where the assertion is that's positive, but I bet it is.
It could be less than 0, but it's still within the...
It certainly...
You said that it can be, negative.
Yeah.
Therefore, can you get...
Let's go back and see where if he actually says that expressly.
Sorry, I didn't hear what the question was.
So the question was, if you look here, I say here's an integer. Actually, it doesn't matter. To tell you the truth, for the proof. So the thing on the right hand side, sorry, left hand side in this case, has absolute value less than m. If you take the absolute value of the right hand side, this and this, then you can take the absolute values of the two things separately. So in the end, all you really care about is the absolute value of that thing is zero, which you did demonstrate.
I apologize, I was late, so I guess that's the answer to this question. But do we care if it's less than m or... Because I have studied this, and when I studied most arithmetics, we didn't, as you said, it's
equivalent to class. I think the customary definition, if I asked you, just sort of close your eyes, what's 5, what's 7 mod 5? What would you say?
You typically answer...
You could say 7. And
but for other answers to the other problems, I give...
Yeah, so really, both as a practical matter and in principle, it should be less than m. So, for example, we're going to study ciphers, which are based on modular arithmetics, and if you transmit a number which is bigger than the modulus, it isn't going to make sense to the poor guy who's expecting it to be less than the modulus.
So are you going to take off points?
Don't worry about the points. I've forgotten this point thing. Now I get it again. Okay. Josh did the full multiplication table, I guess by hand, Josh, or did you do this in Excel?
It took me under 3 minutes just to comment on anybody who was saying, oh, it takes so long, it's so hard.
Well, I was actually going to do it in front of them to deal with the 3-minute problem. But you just did them all out. Here's what I would have done. Here's what I did with this problem when I first saw it. Because, you know, I just worried that I might have done everything wrong again.
And is there no way to just blank it all?
I don't know. This is, I'm learning.
Blank the whole screen.
There probably is. But that's not it. Okay, here's what I would have done. I would have clicked this and, come on, be good. I would have drawn myself a little table. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Okay, for extra credit, what's the next one? 10. And I would have said to myself, okay, the table is nice and symmetric, and if A is the inverse of B, B is the inverse of A. So there's some inverses I know off the top of my head. This is mod 11, just to remind ourselves. I would have said, okay, 1 is its own inverse. 10 is equal to minus 1 mod 11, so minus 1 times minus 1 is 1, so 10 is its own inverse 2. Okay? What about 2? Let's start easy. Anything times 2 equal 1 mod 11? Well, nothing times 2 is 1, but something times 2 is 12, which is the next thing it could be, and that's 6. And since 6 is the inverse of 2, 2 is the inverse of 6. 3 and 4, the same thing work. It turns out 3 times 4 is 12. Pretty good, huh? 4, 3. So now I really only have 4 values which are going to pair off. So I could just try them randomly, but I happen to know, having an excellent undergraduate education, that 5 times 9 is 45, which is 1 mod. And then these two had better be the inverses of themselves unless something terrible happened. So it really is, Josh is right. This is looks much harder when it got turned into an n-squared block than it really is. Okay. And I think Josh demonstrated the inverse stuff here by doing... He did the full multiplication table, which is often quite useful. He points out correctly, if this inverse... If you don't have a prime modulus, you don't have inverses. And here's an easy way to say that. Suppose you have a non-prime inverse, let's say 12. 2, which is not equal to 0, and 6, which is equal to 0, is equal to 0. In a field, in a thing that has an inverse, you can't have two non-zero things multiplying to 0, otherwise terrible stuff happens. So if you have a non-prime modulus, you don't have inverses.
There's a question here?
Yes, I'm sorry. Josh, you should yell out if somebody puts up their hand there, because I don't...
Can you explain this inverse a little better? What do you mean by it?
Is what?
what you mean by an inverse?
Oh, inverse. Okay, so an inverse is the operation in a group, and we're going to talk about groups in a second, which when you perform the group operation turns the thing into the identity. So for multiplication, which is the operation we're talking about, the inverse of a number is the number when you multiply it by, you get 1, which is what he has to do.
So how is 10 its own inverse? Because 10 times, okay, but you're saying 1
10 times 10, 10 is is equal to minus 1 mod 11. Minus 1 times minus 1 is 1. Or if you want to be really hardcore about it, 10 times 10 is 100, which is also equal to 1 mod 11.
Okay.
But again, it's okay in modular arithmetic to use the smaller of the two numbers, for convenience. And in fact, there's a theorem in math called the rule of quadratic reciprocity where good old Gauss switches between those two to his advantage. Okay. Okay, so this one should have been a GitHub giveaway. The exponent was so ridiculous that you had to figure there was a shortcut here. And again, I'll do Josh does it all out. He multiplies 3 to the 1, 3 squared, and so on, and he gets 3 to the 1 mod 11 equals 1, which should have been no surprise because Josh pointed out at the last lecture that a to the p minus 1 mod p is 1. It's a generic theorem. Okay? So, let's see. He didn't say it, but I would say it. He did say it, maybe. And I would say it this way. If you, I'll switch to yellow. So this is 3 to the 10 times some ridiculous number, which I'll call x, plus 4. I'm just going to look at the last digit of that ridiculous number, which is equal mod 11, which is equal to 3 to the 10 to the x times 3 to the 4 mod 11. 3 to the 10 we already discovered was either by looking at Josh's calculation or remembering that any number to the p minus 1 is 1 mod 1 is 1. So 1 to any power is 1. This is equal to 3 to the 4, which is, I would have done it 27 times 4. 27 is 5. You multiply this out and you get the...
Just to state the obvious here, we're talking about primes, though, right?
Primes.
Yeah.
None of the... In fact, the last problem points out that if you have a non-prime modulus, all the stuff I just said is wrong. Okay, and... what's the problem? Oh, there, see, he does the... He actually restates the theorem for you. So, and the last one, again, I found this pretty easy because I just, we're computer science majors and we also sort of remember that 2 to the 6th is 1. So mod 65, 2 to the 6th we know is minus 1, which...
Don, you actually skipped the problem.
I skipped the problem, sorry.
I think I'm actually...
That one. Okay, there it is. Okay. So again, he computes, again, another giveaway, 2 to a ridiculous power, mod 33. And he discovers again, mod 33, 2 to the 10th is 1. So he just has to examine the last digit to find out what the value of the thing is, and it's 31.
Two to the bottom.
Oh, yeah, it should be 2. This is 8.
Thank you.
By the
way, note that this modulus is not prime, but there still is.
But it's still.
Raised to get to 1.
Okay. Now I'll go back to that last problem, if I can find it. There we go. So Josh quotes this theorem that says a to the p minus 1 mod p has got to be 1. Use that fact to show that 65 is not prime, and it doesn't count to say 65 is 5 times 13. He doesn't want you to do that. So what he does is he's going to calculate 2 to the 64 mod 65. And if that's not 1, 65 can't have been prime because it would have violated that theorem. So he calculates that number, and again, you can calculate it fairly easily directly.
We talked about how, or the problem said used to use repeated squares to do that easily.
Yep. Which is what he did here.
So how did you determine then the 2 to the 8 mod 65 was 61? Did he just actually multiply the full thing out then?
Josh, did you actually do the arithmetic here?
How long is it going to take you to figure out 16 times 60? Come on, somebody say it.
It's 2 to the 8th. Everybody knows what 2 to the 8th is. 256.
Which, if you think about it for a moment, is 4 less than 230. Oh, sorry, 260, I'm sorry. Which is 4 times 65, so it's negative 4. It's 4 less than 0. Less than 65.
Yeah, so you can do it that way. Again, here's another trick if you're really averse to doing arithmetic. Again, two to the, and you know many people are, 2 to the 6th is 64, which is minus 1 mod 65. That means 2 to the 12th is equal to 1. That's an equal sign there, in case anybody, mod 65.
Well, which means you have it right there. You have 2 to the 6th is minus 1, and 2 squared is 4. So 2 to the 8th is 2 to the 6th.
Yeah, you could do it that way. I was going to actually do the 2 to the 24th better be 1, and 2 to the 40th equals 1, and then you can calculate 2 to the 64 by multiplying those. But anyway, so you shouldn't be that worried about multiplying 16 by 16 with modular arithmetic, but you can often avoid even that.
I'm worried about it only because these happen to be small exponents, but they're not going to stay small exponents.
That's right, and you better have a computer when they're not small exponents, unless you're really good at arithmetic. Okay, so...
John, question?
Yep. If you start seeing a pattern, like we saw 16, 61, back to 16, does that mean that there's going to continue to be a pattern necessarily, or not necessarily?
Yeah, because you're doing the same operation each time. The pattern is not... Why didn't this go on? I'll go back to the assignment. The very last one?
Yeah.
This one? So if you start out at 6, basically a pattern repeats based on the repetition of the exponent. So, it's just a pattern. If you do the same operation that fits the pattern, you'll get the same pattern showing up. So you can...
Was the question why it goes 1661, 1661? And there's some group structure that happens here because 65 is not prime. And, you know, you can talk about...
Right, but you don't need to know that to answer this.
Right.
Okay. I'm going to move to the thing because we have lots of stuff to cover.
Okay. John, at some point, I'd just like to ask the question about homework turn-ins, what people prefer. We had about... 15 people turn in assignments by mail, which is just fine.
My guess is we had about the same number here.
Well, I got about 15 assignments emailed to me. It's certainly easier, especially if the Redmond people, if they're willing to email things, that makes it easier for us to move them to UW. But I didn't expect so many people to want to email them. So I just want to get a quick sense of how many people would really object to emailing homework and really like turning it in?
Does anybody have a difficult time emailing a solution? No, it looks like they're happy to email. We actually had this question before you showed up.
It might be also timing. I mean, we hear, so I don't know. Some things are just easier to look at paper for me, so I can scan them and put them in PDF, whatever. If I'm doing it 1 hour before class and I need to give the provide the homework on time, then I'll email them.
Okay, I see. So there's definitely at least one person who prefers paper. Are there others who prefer paper? Okay, so several people do. So we'll work it out. I just wanted to get that simple.
Okay.
Do you guys accept that? Have some direction on who we should send it to for email?
So I think what I told people before the class started is email it to the two TAs, both of them.
Okay.
So they both have it. And if you want to be extra super careful, you can CC us.
I have a 2 gig mailbox. What's it matter?
Yeah. Okay. So just to give you a little bit of outline of the course, we're going to talk about symmetric key ciphers and cryptographic caches. I had switched them. Come on, be good. Yeah, we're going to talk about Josh did a great first lecture to develop an intuition about...
still needs work.
God damn. It's still not switching. I did what it said. Let's do it again. Duh? Duh.
Uh-oh. While we're waiting, does anybody know an easy way to pick one of these presentations in classroom presenter and actually print it out? I still really like taking notes on the icons.
Okay. The guy in the back room, I can't get my presentation back up.
Although we see it fine here.
Just take the PowerPoints and print them for us.
The symbols don't work.
I did print the PowerPoints, but the symbols were completely messed up. Like on slide 20, it's just gibberish. And it's could be just a problem with the font. Look at some of yours.
You can explore this to things. You then print that.
Yeah.
But whether you can do anything on this.
I've got the tab showing you the real slides is here, but
on the version 2.1, not just 2.0, it was at HTML and then print that to PDF and then that.
Nope.
But it was a pain in the butt.
Well, we have a 1 minute break here.
John.
Yes.
We can see your slides here. I assume it's supposed to say University of Washington CSE.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, we can't see them here.
I don't know if that helps debug it.
How about those Yankees?
There
okay, there we go. So you guys can still see it?
Yes.
Okay. So, today we're going to talk about symmetric key ciphers and cryptographic hashes. Next week, Josh will talk about public key ciphers. The next two lectures after that, Brian will talk about cryptographic protocols. I'll return, hopefully, and the screen will work next time, and talk about the security of block ciphers, how you determine security. We're going to have gone over one block cipher today. And then that will teach us some stuff that is instructive in figuring out how they developed the latest cryptographic block cipher, AES. And then we'll do some more extensive analysis of cryptographic hashes. Brian will talk in the lecture after that on trusted AI and key management, and these are actually important practical matters. The ninth lecture and the last full three-hour segment on a set of topics that we lecture directly on will be on random numbers and elliptic curve crypto, and then there'll be a special topics day. Okay, so I want to return to the basic paradigm of cryptography and talk about the model of what you're protecting. So here, for symmetric ciphers, one of the nicest models, just look at the privacy model, the wiretap channel. And you imagine a source with a sender called Alice. They could have called it Alex. Alice, who's has some plain text that she wants to transmit over a channel, which can be seen publicly. So typically first she compresses the data in some way so that it's as small as possible. Then she encrypts the data, and that's what the focus of this class is on how you encrypt the data. Then perhaps after that she encodes the data because the channel may be noisy and it may lose bits. So often there's an error correcting code. And then Bob, on his end of the channel, receives that message, decodes it, which and this is what's confusing and why I'm explaining to you. That decode is basically an error-correcting decode. And now you have the original output of the encryption. You decrypt that, typically decompress it, and there's your movie or iPod thing or whatever it is that you're going to watch. Okay? Josh talked a little bit about asymmetric encryption. Today we're going to focus on symmetric encryption. And the basic thing with symmetric encryption is there's one shared secret key. Both parties, authorized parties, share a secret key, which we'll call K. And there's an encryption function, which takes the key and the plain text, and outputs a ciphertext. And then, in order to get it back, in order for this not to be a one-way transformation, there better be a decryption function which takes K, and I noticed I made a mistake, it should take the ciphertext here, huh? That should be C, and emits the plain text. So what Alice put in, Bob gets out. If everything worked out well and they share a secret key. Yes?
Just some definition of terms. When you say the key is the same, you don't mean it's literally the same transformation.
No, the key, which you can think of as a number, is the same number on both sides. You input the same number to the algorithm.
All right.
For the key. Just as the plain text, just think of it as a bit stream. You put in a bit stream, you want the same bit stream out after the decryption. Okay, there's some things you definitely want from a symmetric cipher. You want this transformation to be simple and fast. And as you'll see, that's one of the main reasons to use a symmetric cipher. That key space, the thing you were wondering what you put in, there, that ought to be chosen out of a large enough set so that an adversary can't just try all the keys and see which one works. So the key space has to be large enough. The encryption algorithm has to be effectively invertible, otherwise, poor Bob, you're going to encrypt something and Bob's not going to get it back. There are two types of symmetric ciphers that we'll talk about. We'll talk about mainly one today, block ciphers, where you take a chunk, some standard number of bits, 64 bits of text, and encrypt it and get another 64-bit block out. The other kind of cipher is a stream cipher, where you take, again, just imagine bytes flowing by, and you encrypt each byte as it comes by. A bit, even.
Are they fundamentally different, or is a stream cipher just kind of like tinier blocks?
What you look for actually is different, a little bit different. They both have this, and they have different properties. For example, there are different attacks on one, a very popular attack on a stream cipher. Imagine you're encrypting withdrawal in a stream cipher. So you're XORing a bunch of stuff. Let me give you an example when we get up to one-time paths, which will show you. They're different. They have different properties, and you want to be careful of them. Okay, so why bother? Here's in a few slides why you bother with symmetric key ciphers. So the pretty ciphers, the ciphers based on mathematical techniques like elliptic curves or factoring, like RSA 1024, 1024 stands for the modulus, the encryption takes on some specified hardware that I looked up some time ago, about 32 hundredths of a millisecond per operation, and each operation encrypts about 127 and a half or 128 bytes. 127 and a half because whatever you encrypt has to be less than the modulus, and the modulus is 1024 bytes. So if you look at the rate, you can encrypt stuff. It's 384 kilobytes per second, which is not blazingly fast. If you're encrypting video, you've got a little bit of a problem here. The decrypt operation is even slower on RSA. RSA is very asymmetric in its encryption versus decryption operation. It takes about 10 milliseconds per operation to decrypt. And that means 13 kilobytes per second, which is slower still. Again, these times are faster on faster processors, but all these numbers are measured on the same processor. Now, if you look at a block cipher, a symmetric cipher, the popular one right now, AES-128, the encryption per block, and a block is 16 bytes long, is 53 microseconds per operation, or 3 megabytes per second, which is plenty fast for anything you ever want to do, even if you don't have specialized hardware. This is on a standard PC. DES was a bit slower. In fact, one of the reasons DES was redesigned is people had been using triple DES, which has, reasonably good security, but it's pretty slow.
Compared to triple or?
This is just single DES. If you did triple DES, it would be three times as slow. Some people might ask, well, why didn't we just stick with DES and add more stages, and it's slow. There are other reasons, but if you look at, yes?
Sorry, even though it's slower, is it any more secure, or is it actually less secure than AES?
I think DES.
Well, DES certainly is less secure. DES has been broken, or reinforced in key space. The current triple DES, it kind of depends. I guess the best known stuff still gives you to the 112, right?
Yeah. So although there's always, you like to build secure ciphers as a secure operation, so there's probably more skepticism about triple DES than AES, because you're just worried, since DES, since an elementary part of it is breakable, you worry always that
there's, as you'll see when John gets on a bit, some of it's about sort of gut feel about the ugly function at the middle of it.
That's right.
There's some things we've learned about AES that may have a little more structure in it than you might like. Right. And so there's a gut feel, but right now, AES 128 up to 256 is sort of our best gut. Kind of the only thing that really we recommend at this point.
The other reason for ugly is just key size.
I was going to ask you to remind us of what CRT stands for on the previous slide. Is that one of those optimizations? I remember sliding window, but not CRT. On the previous one before this.
Chinese Remainder Theorem. Sorry. Thank you.
Yep.
The other reason is key size. Per bit for known attacks, per bit, once you know the key, symmetric ciphers require much less storage for the key. So, for example, a 128-bit symmetric key, I've got to learn to point with this, has roughly the same security as a 3072-bit RSA key, and there is another public key algorithm, elliptic curve, which reduces that difference. But still, even with elliptic curve, which is a pretty whose design goal was compressed key size, is still twice as big as the symmetric key size.
Did you mean to skip slide 7?
I thought did I mention that? I didn't. I thought I had, but when I went back, I forgot. The cryptographic hashes, the practical ones we're going to talk about, run at roughly the same speeds as symmetric ciphers. So they're also quite fast. So the poor public key ciphers are the outliers on speed. And, of course, cryptographic hashes have no keys, as we'll learn.
What about elliptic curve? Do they run a little faster than...
Yeah, actually, the last slide, which I was not going to... No, I took it out. I don't seem to have it here. Yeah, if you go, depending on the corresponding symmetric key size, they are alleged to be faster. And in fact, the bigger the key size, the faster they are relative to RSA. They also use simpler operations sometimes. So they're very popular on small devices. Again, so if you talk about security or cryptography in the absence of an adversary, you're already in a state of sin. So whenever we talk about ciphers and what we're protecting, there's always an adversary we're trying to protect ourselves against. The common one we try to protect ourselves against for a symmetric key cipher, the old-fashioned one, the one we'll think about at first, is the eavesdropper, which is what Eve stands for, who's sitting there, you transmit a message on a wire that they can tap or over the ether on radio that they can listen to, and you want them not to be able to understand what you're saying, but you want Bob on the other side of the wire or on the other antenna, the authorized receiving party, to understand it. You want to get that back. So Eve is a passive adversary. Most modern symmetric ciphers are designed, and it's important for many of the applications, for a much more powerful adversary. And that's an adversary who gets to sit in between the sender and the receiver. And sometimes this adversary even gets you to encrypt plain text they want. So you want a cipher that is secure against an attacker who can hand you a bunch of plain text, have you encrypt it, but still not have any way to decrypt the plain text you've sent to someone else in your message. Adversaries are characterized by a couple of characteristics, the computational resources they have and they can bring to bear against attacking you, the kind of ciphertext they have. They may have probable plain text. Almost everybody has probable plain text. If you're sending a message to your bank, you'll probably mention your bank account. Known corresponding plain ciphertext, so they may know a particular message that you sent for some reason and the corresponding ciphertext. That's the standard attack. And again, just like Mallory, they may have a chosen plain text attack. They may be able to hand you plain text, which you'll which will dutifully encrypt, see the ciphertext, and see if that helps them break the cipher. That is, to determine either the key or to be able to decrypt other blocks or other things. And the final one, which is another chosen plaintext tap, is an adaptive attack. Having seen some output that you've encrypted, they may get to say more things based on that output to you. They may hand you more ciphertext. So a good symmetric cipher is, a modern one, is supposed to protect you from all these attacks. And as we see, we'll see in the development of ciphers, the older ones have fewer of these characteristics than the newer ones. The other thing that characterizes an adversary is physical access. And that's actually important because many of the attacks on good ciphers have almost nothing to do with breaking the cipher. They have to do with being able to get inside information. So an outsider threat, that's the threat where, you know, I basically encrypted something and sent it over the wire, and you get to look it over the wire. An insider threat, which may be running in the same machine you're running in when you encrypt, and that's actually an important attack. And all kinds of stuff can be brought to bear on that. Timing attacks, where the length of time it takes to do a basic cryptographic operation can disclose information about a key. You may not see the information, but might see the timing effect. People can actually steal keys because operating systems may not protect your address space well enough. And then there's the trusted insider attack, the guy who's actually supposed to guard the key. If you have a trusted insider and you're pretty much hosed, he's going to get the key and the best you can do is audit and find out where he is. So, okay, so I'm going to take you back historically in the design of ciphers because a lot of... in symmetric ciphers and really in public key ciphers.
Question here?
Yes, question. Thank you, Josh.
It seems like there are two things that you might want to crack. One is you might want to learn what the plain text was if you have some ciphertext, and the other is you might want to learn what the key is. And maybe attacks for those would be different.
They're different attacks, but in the end, usually it doesn't do you too much good to. In other words, if I can break a cipher without knowing a key, which means you put an arbitrary plain text, you give me the ciphertext, I can tell you what the plain text is, I really, in this scenario, doesn't matter. That's as good as getting a key. There's a performance issue. If I actually find the key, then I'm just as good as you at decrypting. But both of them are bad. For a symmetric cipher, they're bad.
So last week we talked about an attack where if you could get 65,000 people to all encrypt the same secret, then you could figure out what the secret was.
Yeah, there was one of the public key things. Was this the padding thing, Josh?
The Hotstead attack.
Yeah, the Hotstead attack, right.
So where does that fit into the one, to the...
That's a known... Again, you can think of that as a known plain text attack, or even, sorry, a chosen plain text attack, perhaps. You've gotten 65,000 different encryptions and corresponding ciphertext, and that helps you break the cipher. Okay, so we're going to go back. I'm going to take you back about 40 years to ciphers in World War II, where we learned a lot because many of the requirements are the same. So if you're out in the, you're trying to encrypt stuff and you're in the military, you want something that's universally available. You can't carry six machines for the six possible people you're going to send stuff to, right? You want it to be rugged. You want it to be light. Since somebody's going to manufacture 100,000 of these machines, you don't want the security to depend on the fact that nobody's captured one of these machines. The security of your messages should only depend on the knowledge of your key. So you want a cipher. One of the primary design requirements of ciphers is that a person who has a lot of information about this, all the information about a cipher design, and possibly chosen plain text, even those guys cannot break the cipher. That's the requirement. Even in World War II, we're at the point where an adversary had access to some corresponding plain and ciphertext. So even in World War II, the ciphers had to be secure against some class of corresponding plain ciphertext attacks. These days, actually, it's worse. Adversaries have access basically to an unlimited amount of ciphertext for most ciphers. The implementation is in digital devices where speed is paramount. You want to encrypt a video stream. So speed and ease of use is really quite important. Yeah?
You talk about how today they have unlimited amounts of ciphertext. Well, isn't that almost irrelevant because most of the algorithms that are being used today are completely published and open and we know...
No, there are two separate things. Whether you know the algorithm and then you have the algorithm and you have a key and you get a guy to... and you get a bunch of corresponding plain cipher text, it's can you break the cipher, discover the key? They're really two separate issues.
Yeah,
we want both to happen.
I thought you were saying that they have unlimited access to the ciphertext because of the fact that on the internet we've got just tons and tons of traffic going on.
What I'm saying is, I'm saying both. So first of all, because of this design principle, all modern algorithms are public, basically. All non-classified algorithms are public, period. Everybody has access to them.
Yeah.
It's a given. Your adversary has the same access as you do. But also because of how much we encrypt, we're not super... and we don't instruct people to be super careful about what they encrypt. You know, typically an adversary will have lots and lots of corresponding plain ciphertext to work with, and you still want to be safe from that adversary for the thing, you know, he doesn't have. And that we these days, it's very important for computers to find the cipher easy to implement. So small computers on cell phones, a design requirement will have to do with what kind of arithmetic operations are required for the cryptographic cipher. And the ciphers have to be resistant to just really ridiculous amounts of computing power. The practical attacks, you know, you still have to pay attention to them. Can somebody check all the keys that could possibly have encrypted your message? That's the first attack, the easiest one to pull off. Second easiest attack is, suppose somebody picks dopey keys. If I have the greatest cipher in the world, and I always pick the key 0, it's going to be pretty easy for you to break my cipher. So, you know, you'll just learn by habit. As for practical ciphers, good ones, bad management, key management, and key storage are the easiest way to get break into a system. Bribing a key holder is always a winner. If you can get that to happen, that's good. Side channel and timing attacks, where you're standing next to the cryptographic operation in a separate part of the, you know, of the computer, and you can watch how quickly things happen. That sometimes discloses information about keys. Exploiting encryption errors, that's less popular now than it was in the old ciphers. Many of the old ciphers breaks happened because people made simple mistakes and then corrected them, and that gave some more corresponding text that you wouldn't have had before. Anyway, those are the practical attacks. Many people spend a lot of time, and I've listed two, trying to list formal requirements for symmetric key ciphers, and I'm not a big fan of formal requirements, indistinguishability, non-malleability. There's a bunch of game-like attacks, like suppose I've given you some fixed amount of plain cipher text. Do you have any measurable advantage in decrypting the next block? In fact, most professionals don't really pay a lot of attention to formal attack requirements like this. Mostly what they pay attention to is this. They look at the best attacks known on cipher systems and see how resistant the cipher is to those attacks. It's always good to have a second level of protection. If you can prove a theoretical result, it's good. But again, even in public key ciphers, it's very hard to actually capture all the things that can go wrong in a formal model. So, in fact, you pay a lot of attention to the way you know people can break ciphers. So you do a risk assessment. For example, in AES, when we described the AES design, an enormous amount of attention in AES and the winning candidate was spent to defeating the two best attacks on block ciphers, namely linear and differential cryptanalysis. And you'll learn about that in one of the lectures. So deciding about the security of a cipher and what cipher to use is really a judgment call. It depends on knowing what the state of the art is, what the level of protection your information needs, what the likely attackers are, what resources they have, and balancing all those. Okay, so I'm going to define the two major class of ciphers, and I guess we should take a 10-minute break. So the first cipher is a block cipher, and typically I'll describe this digitally. You have M bits, which are encrypted by the encrypting function EK, and is a, let's call it a key bit key, and when you encrypt something, you get another m-bit, m-bits out. That's a block cipher. You can think of a block cipher as being a key-dependent map, which takes all 2 to the m possible block messages, m-bits, 2 to the m messages, and permutes them based on the action of the key. Right, so for a given m-bit input, I get some other m-bit output. So the key gets to select from an enormous number of permutations. So the key really selects from all n factorial possible permutations which could be implemented by the block cipher. And this is Stirling's formula, which lets you estimate that. The square root goes over that. So for when n, for example, is 2 to the 56, you'll do a homework problem which will demonstrate the size of this permutation group is immense. Okay. Maybe I'll do two more slides just because we had that little blip with the thing. I'm not going to talk too much about block cipher modes, but the model I presented, in which I take an m-bit input and get an m-bit output, is one mode of using a block cipher, and it's called the electronic code book method. So if I have 5 cipher blocks in the electronic code book mode, I hand each of the 5 blocks successively to the encryption function, I get 5 successive blocks out, and I transmit them in order. That's the electronic codebook method. It has a few advantages, and here's an interesting example of an attack that you might not think of. Suppose I'm using a cipher to transmit whether I agree to something or I disagree to something. So I'm going to transmit a yes or no, and I encrypt it. I encrypt the yes or the no with my block cipher. Use electronic code book, and the yes and no fit in a block. The encryption of yes is going to be the same every time, and the encryption of no is going to be the same every time. So if I've gotten one corresponding plain cipher text, like the yes or the no, and I'm eavesdropping on the channel, from then on, even though you have the best block encryption algorithm in the world, without breaking the key and without breaking the cipher, I know whether you said yes or no over the channel. So that's an example of an attack that depends on the mode. The two most common modes, I think, right now are the CBC mode. What you start out with an initial vector, which is public, and you encrypt the plain text. This is, and you XOR that. With the last cipher block. And then that yes-no problem I talked to you about goes away, because you never are encrypting the same block of interest. Typically, you're unlikely to do that. It has a few disadvantages. It can't really be done in parallel. I've listed 3 other. One of the most popular ones right now, and the newest one, is the counter mode, where you start out with a nonce, and you up the counter, you encrypt a counter and the nonce each time, and you XOR that with a plain text. You got to be really you got to be really careful when you use the cipher. You better never use the nonce again. This is almost a block cipher used in stream cipher mode, which brings me to stream cipher. A stream cipher, think of it as encrypting each bit as it comes along. So here's a very simple encryption mechanism. It's called a one-time pad. I generate a huge amount of random bits, and I'll call that the key. Gigabytes of disk of random numbers. And for the message, and again, remember the two parties to this message, Bob and Alice, both have that key sitting on their computer. When I want to send a message M, and message bit M sub T, the full message is T goes from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. All I do is XOR that with the key bit. That's what I transmit. So the cipher text is the input text XORed with the key. And it turns out, by some definition, which we'll talk about significantly later, that's really a provably secure cipher. It's one of the few provably secure ciphers, symmetric ciphers in the world. It's self-reciprocal, which means it's easy to decrypt. When I get the text C sub T, in order to get M sub T back, I just XOR X sub T again, and out pops C of T. So, can anybody see what the problem with the cipher is? Yeah.
Distributing the key must be a
pain. Distributing the key is a pain in the butt. So, most stream ciphers, what they do is they still keep the key small, and they generate pseudo-random sequences based on the smaller key. One of the ciphers we're going to talk about, RC4, does that. So that's absolutely the disadvantage, and that's key size. Okay, so here actually this is here's another interesting attack on a cipher that you can mount if you're not careful. Suppose you use a stream cipher, this cipher, with a pseudo-random number, so you're not worried about key sizes, and you encrypt banking transactions. Now, the adversary knows the format of the banking transaction, and he knows that you're going to transmit a number in binary, and it's always going to be a 34-bit number. Suppose the adversary arranges for you to transfer, using this encryption algorithm, 35 cents to him. You're probably pretty gullible. 35 cents, what the hell? You're willing to transfer that to almost anybody. Well, all that guy does, without breaking the algorithm, is he XORs in that position a 1 and have you send him 2 to the 20th plus $30 plus 25 to 35 cents. The way to stop that is to use something we'll learn about a little later with cryptographic hashes, a message integrity thing in there. But there's an attack on the stream cipher which you really can't reasonably mount on a block cipher. So there's another interesting attack. Okay, so when we resume in, I'm going to say 7:37, in case anybody works at Boeing, we'll talk about the ciphers in World War II and as an introduction to how people design symmetric ciphers. Be back, same back time. Okay, ready to start? We're going to talk about manual ciphers, partly because many of the design principles and much of the evolution in these manual ciphers, and by manual I mean by hand, that encryption people did by hand before, say, 1920. Many of the design principles are very similar, and the evolution of attacks on the manual ciphers in many ways mirrors the attacks that have been made on more sophisticated ciphers. So there's a lot of text out there on manual ciphers. There's a bunch of text. There are a bunch of devotees who lovingly chronicle all kinds of manual ciphers and machine ciphers like Enigma and M209. So I'm not going into too super much detail, but enough detail so that you know some of the basic ciphers. So we're going to talk about simple transpositions where you change the order of letters. All these ciphers are on an alphabet. And think of the alphabet as A, B, C, D, E, F, G, all the way up to Z. Could be something else, but that's that. So transposition ciphers move letters around in a message. Substitution ciphers substitute letters for other letters. And as we'll discover, there's a set of attacks when you either substitute a single letter or transpose letters. And so as people move from simple substitution, monoalphabetic substitution ciphers, to polyalphabetic ciphers and then polygraphic ciphers. And you'll see what those look like. But first, I want to define just a tiny bit of notation. And this slide might scare a few people, but it's a compact notation for describing substitutions and transpositions. And it's useful both in the manual ciphers and in the modern ciphers. So, in Redmond, how many people have heard of a group and know what a group is? A non-commutative group, like the group of permutations? Boy, more people left out. Okay, so I'm going to describe it. You may have to glance at a book, an elementary algebra book, an abstract algebra book, if you get confused afterwards. Hopefully you won't have to know too much of this, but knowing it will help. Okay, so a group is a set equipped with a binary operation. Addition is a set of over the integers, and it's equivalent to binary operation plus. It's an infinite set. And the operation has to satisfy a few properties. The first property is that the operation, and the operation is indicated by juxtaposing elements, has to be associative. And that means that if I have three elements of the group, X, Y, and Z, and I multiply, and I often will fall into the habit of calling the binary operation between the elements multiplying. If I multiply X and Y first in that order, and then multiply it by Z, I get the same result as if I multiply Y and Z in that order, and then multiply that by X and that result in that order. That's associativity. There's an identity element, an element which has the property that when you multiply, apply the binary operation to any element of the group, you get back the element of the group. In a multiplicative group, that's 1. So 1 times any number is the number. In an additive group that you're familiar with, like integers, the identity element is 0. 0 plus any number is 0. Okay? And finally, and the very last rule, is that for every element of a group, there's an inverse. And we talked about inverses for the groups mod 11 just earlier in the homework assignment. An inverse of an element X is an element called X to the minus 1. That's how we denote it. And if you multiply X by X to the minus 1, you get the identity element back. That's a group. Okay? The reason that groups are useful in cryptography is they're a nice shorthand for operations. The group we'll be most interested in is not the rational numbers or the integers, but it'll be the group of substitutions. So if I have 10 elements, let's say, and I look at all the transformations which map that group of 10 elements onto that group of 10 elements, again, the fancier words, bijective transformations between that set of elements itself, one-to-one and onto transformations. Anyway, permutations of those things, that forms a group. And the binary operation is if you have two permutations, you apply them in succession. And that becomes another permutation. Because if I permute the block of, if I permute n things one way, and then permute it another way, I'll still get a block of those same n things. So that's the binary operation. Most people, you can think of the permutations as functions, which take an element of this block and convert it to another element of the block. And you can think of the permutations as being applied to that element to achieve a result. If you read any of the cryptography books, the older ones that have manual ciphers, or even some of the old group theory books, while it's common to apply operations on the left these days, which is this functional syntax, in the older books you'll often see functions or permutations applied from the right. So, and here's an example to make this all nice and concrete. So I'm going to look at the group. I won't actually tell you what Lagrange's theorem is. I was hoping that would just be a review, but I think I'm going to be satisfied if you just know the group notation. Let's look at the group, which is the permutation on 4 things. The numbers 1, 2, 3, 4. So every element of the group permutes 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay? Here's a typical element of the group, which I'll describe this way. The element sigma takes 1 and sends it to 2, takes 2 and sends it to 3, takes 3 and sends it to 4. So it takes 1, 2, 3, 4 to 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay?
And sends 4 to 1,
right? It's important that 1 be in the act. Okay, here's a different permutation. The permutation delta, which takes 1 to 3, 2 to 4, 3 to 1, and 4 to 2. Okay? So let's find the inverse of this. This is a nice simple permutation. Unfortunately. Let's find the inverse of this one. This is simpler. The inverse of delta takes 1 to 3, so its inverse better take 3 back to 1. Look at that. Delta takes 3 back to 1. delta, if 2 goes into 4, 4 better go back to 2. Look at that, delta takes 4 back to 2. So delta is a nice permutation, which is its own inverse. And they're called involutions. Yes?
The inverse of the other one isn't too difficult either, because it's just reversing the order.
It is. And once you've got good notation for writing them, it's really easy to do inverses. So the good notation for delta, well, I was going to do it on this one. One way to write permutations on four things is this way. You write 1, 2, 3, 4, and then you write the number that it goes to here. And it's easy, see, to invert it. You just take the bottom row, put it on the top row, and put it in order. Keep the columns aligned. So it is comparatively easy to find permutations. There is one other way to denote permutations which is quite useful, and it's called the cyclic cyclic presentation, I guess. So let's take permutation sigma. Here's how I'm going to figure out the cyclic permutation. I put a left parenthesis. I pick one number, 1. 1 goes into 2. 2 goes into 3. 3 goes into, 3 is like that, John. And 3 goes into 4. And then 4 goes back into 1. So I end the parenthesis. So now I don't have to have two rows. Let's do the for delta. Delta, 1 goes into 3. 3 goes back to 1. So I put a parenthesis. 2 goes into 4. And 4 goes back into 2. Okay, so here are two compact ways to represent a permutation. And both are used in practice. Okay, so now we have our first cipher. It's a transposition cipher. And here the group theory is just another bookkeeping thing. You don't actually need to know it. When you actually do the cipher, you don't know any group theory, but I want to get you trained to the notation, with the notation. So I want to transmit the message, Bowinkle is a dope. And the key for a transposition cipher is how you move the letters around. And a common one is a grill. Basically, you set out a geometric pattern. And so you write, Bullwinkle is a dope in this 4 by whatever it is column. You write the letters left to right, top to bottom. And then what you do, the cipher, is you go down the column. So the first letters of the cipher is that. And then the next letters are that. And then the next letters are that. Okay? Now, if you want to get really fancy with a grill cipher, in addition to doing that, you may also permute the columns. Okay? That's all there is to a transposition cipher. You can write a transposition cipher this way using group theory notation. So each plain text, each letter, P sub I and C sub I represent the cipher text letters and the plain text letters in order. So if you take the plain text letter and apply the appropriate permutation where it moved in the message, you get the cipher text letter.
So whoever's going to decipher that would need to know the dimensions of the grill.
Exactly. They need to know the dimensions of the grill and the order that if you permuted the columns of the grill. Those are the two things. To break the cipher, to find the key, that's what you need to find out. Okay? I wrote this out in cyclic notation because you can notice from the cyclic notation for this cipher, there's something a little weird here. There's one letter, the B, which always stays in the same place. So this is a good reason to permute the columns. Okay, how might you break a cipher like this? As I said, symmetric key cryptanalysis is all about I propose a scheme, break it. If you can't break it, it's kind of like NP completeness. Nobody can prove NP completeness, but what you say is a lot of smart people tried to solve this problem efficiently and they can't. So I believe it. I believe it's hard. So in this case, you say a lot of smart people tried to break my cipher and they didn't do it, which is why peer review is so important. So here's how you would break a completely filled columnar transposition. That's one where you have a rectangle, just like I did before, but it's completely filled. You don't allow messages which are partial. And this is a real one from a book, actually a nice book in manual ciphers called Elementary Cryptanalysis by Sinkoff. So I look at the message. I know it's a completely filled grill, which is a rectangular array. I counted this, which I'm not going to do in real time because I'll get the wrong answer. And I find out there are 77 letters. So I've got in a rectangular array with 77 letters. 77 is 7 times 11. I can only do that with two kinds of rectangles, a 7 by 11 rectangle and an 11 by 7 rectangle. Okay, so that's the first thing you do in cryptanalysis of transposition of a completely filled columnar transposition. So I decided to try 7 columns, 11 rows. So here's what happens when I wrote that out, this thing on the left. And I happen to know, or I guess, that the guy is not a complete idiot. He's really going to permute the columns. So it's pretty easy to do something called anagramming. You move the columns as a unit until you find a word. And here's how you decrypt it. There are many pieces of information you could do. You can look for the word the, and that often is a clue. In transposing this. Anyway, I transpose these columns and I get this message. Greece announced yesterday that it reached whatever it is. It's a message. This is an interesting one because, look, it may be a little bit hard. You might imagine anagramming is a little bit hard and maybe somebody didn't do a completely filled grill. But if I give you, in this case, 7 letters of corresponding plain ciphertext, any old 7 letters of plain and corresponding ciphertext in order, you can break a trivium because it tells you the column length, where the columns are, everything. So this is an interesting example of a cipher that was used that may provide some security against when the adversary knows nothing. But if he knows a little something, it really doesn't provide much security. Okay, the next ciphers, although it will turn out that the transposition cipher, which introduces something we call diffusion into the information, is a basic element of strong ciphers. Yes?
Are there mathematical techniques that you could use on ciphers like this to just, like, by sheer brute force, kind of, with a computer?
Based on what?
I don't know, I'm just trying to think of...
The short answer is yes. So if you have any corresponding in plain text, you can do it.
Okay.
Easy. It turns out English is pretty restrictive, right? So what you're really doing when you're doing this is moving things around. And if I see an English word, I probably got the right key. English, it turns out, is redundant. It's for every, roughly, 4 bits of English, there's 1 bit of information. So, in English messages, as we're all doing in alphabetic text, there's usually enough redundant information to discover whether your guess is right. And you can use that either in an automated way. Many of these, it's easy just to do it by sight. Yeah. Okay, the second mechanism is called alphabetic substitution, where you take a letter and you substitute another letter. And you can do 2 things. The first example I'll give is a monoalphabetic substitution. So I use 1 alphabet all the time. The letter A always goes into the same letter. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but it's always the same letter. Then there's a polyalphabetic cipher, which means the letter in the first position gets permuted into some letter. If that same letter appears in the second position, it goes to a second letter. And I'll show you how you might do this with a manual key in a way that, you know, Alice and Bob can both remember it. Then we'll attack those ciphers, and it'll turn out there's a weakness because of frequency. This thing you've all seen when you were kids, you know, these are most common English letters, so you can break these ciphers pretty easy. So the next thing people did was to encrypt letters as units, 2 letters together. And that's called a polygraphic cipher. So here's the first substitution cipher. It's a famous one, I guess, historically, because Caesar used it. And again, it's my favorite, Bullwinkle is a dope. And the polyalphabetic substitution is, for every letter in the alphabet, you just move 2 to the right. So B goes to D, U goes to W, and it's the same alphabet each time. So the encryption of Bullwinkle is a dope is this unreadable string. Yes?
I assume Caesar didn't use our 26-letter alphabet, though.
I guess they used to have 25-letter alphabet, which turns out when I get to Hill is better because that's a field.
Okay.
And in fact, Caesar didn't use K equals 2. He didn't say skip 2 letters. He said skip 3 letters, which isn't much harder to break. Now, if I represented this with group theory, what I'd say is not that the position of the letter is permuted, but the letter itself is permuted. So again, applying the permutation A goes to B, goes to C, goes to D, if I cube that permutation, in other words, if I apply that permutation three times, it moves the letter over three times. So A goes to 1, 2, 3, D. A goes to E. So in group theory notation, you can write the Caesar cipher as the ciphertext letter. God, you can't see it when I point it. The ciphertext letter is the plain text letter, and then you apply the cyclic permutation K times. Permutation moves letter to the next one. Okay? So the sole key, the only thing you need to know to break this message is that little K. One number. One number will do. And by the way, going back to plain and corresponding ciphertext, if I know 1, 1, 1 corresponding plain and ciphertext letter, I have broken the cipher. So it's absolutely not immune to corresponding plain ciphertext text. Okay, the other thing about monoalphabetic substitutions is they don't hide the frequency of the letters. So as you all know, letters occur with different frequency. So here's the letter frequency, and I'll show you some graphs of this. In English, the most common letter is E. I'll talk about probable words. You also might use polygraphic frequencies. So if you see an N, here are common digraphs, two-letter sequences, trigraphs, words. Another very easy way to break substitution ciphers is just try to position common words in the cipher. And once you've found a few letters, just see what makes sense. It's a very common thing. It's called sliding component. If you look at the frequency distribution, I copied this out of a book. It was ugly, so I did an Excel thing, which is prettier. It has a characteristic graph. And if I had a Caesar cipher, for example, what I'd see in this graph is the same shape, but everything would be moved over three letters. So it would be really easy to spot if you had this. In fact, here it is. If you took that first ugly picture and compared it to the second ugly picture, it would be the same ugly picture with the same distribution, but everything shifted to the right. So it's easy to find this. So the weakness of this system is there's really only one little thing you need to know, and that's how far over in a direct standard alphabet, that is the alphabet in order A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, the letter moved, and you know everything. Okay? So people said, that's not such a great idea. Let's use many letters. I'm sorry, let's use many alphabets. So if I want to encrypt something like get out now, I pick 6 different alphabets to encrypt and then reapply it. Now, people can't remember 6 totally different alphabets. So the historical way to do this is you pick a code word. And the code word here is symbol. Okay? You write symbol down, you write the regular letters up here, you write symbol underneath the A, and then you just complete the alphabet after a while. So S-T-U-V-H-I-J-K, a lot of people. So let's encrypt get out now, which I believe was an actual cipher. And probably good advice. So the plain text letter is G. At the first alphabet, the ciphertext letter is Y. Y. The next plain text letter is E. I have to encrypt that with the second alphabet. Corresponding cipher alphabet text is C. Okay? And then so on. And then I repeat after 6 letters. So the nice thing about a monoalphabetic substitution is that it will to some extent erase the frequency distribution that that the Caesar cipher was a complete mess at. You can do many things. In addition to using many alphabets, you can also change the order of the alphabet. I'm always going to stick, and especially in the homework problem, so that you get to do something during the week other than break ciphers. We're always going to stick with direct standard alphabets. So all the mono alphabets I use, it will be in order. The alphabet will be in order. You can imagine mixing up the letters too. And one easy way for people to mix up the letters is you introduce a keyword like New York City, and then you fill in the letters that don't appear on the word, the keyword, and that's the substitution alphabet. But we're not going to worry about that. Just another thing to do. So a multi-alphabetic cipher is called a Ligonier cipher. And to break it, you have to figure out the number of alphabets, and then you have to figure out one letter, if it's a direct standard alphabet, in each of those alphabets. And then you can write that block thing just the way Bob could have, if Bob's the recipient of the message. There are a number of ways to do this. I'm going to talk about statistics because it's important, but there are a number of ways to do this. Because English has so much redundancy, it will turn out many common words appear at... So if the is encrypted with the second alphabet in the two position for the, it's actually quite probable that somewhere else in the alphabet the will be encrypted in the same position. You can count the difference between the T in the first one and the key in the second one. You look for repeated strings, like XYZ. Maybe let's make believe that's what the turned into. If you see two XYZs, there's a good chance the same word encrypted. You don't know the value of the word, but you know that it's probably the same word. And you look for how many letters are between those two instances. And the number of letters, the number of alphabets, will divide the number of letters between those common things. So that's one way to define it. Another easy way to do it and automate it is take a common word and just try it everywhere across the text. It's easy to do on a computer. And when you find it that one that works, in other words, when you use that substitution that you found in many places and it looks like it makes sense, that's another way to break it. Okay?
That case you just mentioned where you had XYZ in two different places, mm-hmm. does that only occur when the distance between those two is a certain amount?
Yeah. So if I have six alphabets, it better be a multiple of six.
Okay.
If I have seven alphabets, it better be a multiple of seven. And then if you find many of them, it's the greatest common denominator. Each of those differences has to be the greatest common denominator. But again, that's a little bit sophisticated, but just, though these are really easy to break, especially in an automated attack where you just try a bunch of stuff. But we're actually going to look at a slightly more sophisticated mechanism. What we're going to do is say, look, no matter what question.
Has anyone ever developed a cipher where the ciphertext decodes to potentially many plain texts, all of which makes sense?
Yeah, actually, we're going to talk about that. One of them that's a real cipher, that happens in a real cipher called a Jefferson cipher, which I hope we get to talk about for a second. In fact, the notion that a ciphertext in real life, it's really not a great benefit for a plain text to go into several ciphertexts or vice versa, because you confuse the poor guy on the other side. He has to think hard. And you never want him to think hard. If he's a computer, you really don't want him to think hard. It turns out finding a decryption which makes unique sense helps you determine the security of a cipher. And in fact, the amount of text you can have before you get a unique decode in a language, say English, based on information called the unicity distance. But there are ciphers that were used in the past, and the Jefferson cipher is one I can do off the top of my head, where a single plain text block could go to many ciphertext blocks. Okay, so we're going to look at a statistical test. And the statistical test basically looks at the text message and counts the frequency of each letter. Now, the identity of the letter, if you have a monoalphabetic substitution, is going to change. In other words, E is no longer going to be the most popular letter. But the frequencies are not going to change because you did a monoalphabetic substitution. So if, for example, you knew you had one alphabet, and let's say you knew it was direct standard alphabet, you do a frequency count, look for the most common letter, that's probably the E. And then do a trial decode in your home. Now we're going to do something a little bit more sophisticated for two reasons. One is we want a test that lets us know how many alphabets have been used. And we also want a mechanism that lets us determine whether a monoalphabet was used when the letters are scrambled, they're not direct. standard, as they call it in English. And that that test is called the index of coincidence test. And there's a theory here. I won't really basically explain it. But the basic idea is simple. You take a text, you tally all the letters, and you multiply the probabilities or the frequencies of the letters, the square. And it's a measure of roughness. For a monoalphabet, it will be characteristic of an English frequency. And in fact, in English, the index coincidence is about 0.07. It's actually 0.066, but let's... Okay? If you had a purely random text, if people were picking letters at random, then each letter would have a probability of 1 out of 26, and it would be fairly flat. So for a piece of random text, you would expect an index of coincidence of about 1 over 26 or 0.038. So if you're the adversary, you're the cryptanalysis, and you want to see if some block of text comes from a single alphabet, what you do is apply the index of coincidence test. And if you get a high index of coincidence, close to 0.07, you say, this probably comes from a single alphabet. If you get a low index of coincidence, you say, this is probably from several alphabets. For encrypted English text. It's an interesting measure. And in fact, you can develop a formula if you are encrypting n letters with m alphabets. It's actually somewhere in between, as you'd expect. You can actually develop a formula.
And for today's encryption, the computers use the index of coincidence. It's almost always...
Yeah, everything today is you would never learn anything from statistics. They'd all be flat. In fact, somebody proposes a cipher with no flat statistics. They didn't even do the first half hour's worth of work.
John.
Yeah.
In the equation there, what's in the numerator and what's in the denominator?
Who's the person talking? Can you read here?
Right.
Okay. This one here?
Yeah, that n minus m, is that in the numerator or is that in the denominator?
Yeah, so that I couldn't write it since I didn't have LaTeX, but I'll improve here. Yeah, n, it's 1 over m times n minus m divided by n minus 1.
Okay.
That didn't help, John. Write it out.
Oh, okay, so I'm going to write, I'll write this here. That's a good idea. 1 over m times n minus m over n minus 1 times 0.07. You get the idea, right?
Yep.
Okay. So we actually don't need this final level of granularity. Here's the trick when you get a big and your cipher. If you want to figure out how many alphabets were used, you break the cipher up. What you do is you say, okay, I'm going to assume one letter was used. So I'm going to break it into one column thing, do the index of coincidence test. Then I'm going to break it into two. If there were two alphabets used, then every alternating letter comes from the same alphabet. So if I write the message in a column too wide, I do the index of coincidence down one column, and if two alphabets were used, I'll get an index of coincidence of 0.07 about. There are three alphabets used, I write it out in a three column format. And I go down the column, I do the index of coincidence. Does everybody get the idea? So when you get a good index coincidence for all the columns, you probably have figured out how many alphabets were used. That's cute, and you'll enjoy doing the cryptanalysis. Now, there are many, many, many techniques used for manual ciphers to break them. You may not just use frequency of a single letter. You might use multi-graph substitution. Sometimes when you discover a letter, you have the next letter that in the cipher appears with high probability, like Q, is often followed by U. In English. There's something called alphabet chaining, where if you have two different alphabets, you may not be able to tell the identity of alphabet 1 or alphabet 2, but you can map alphabet 2 to alphabet 1. So now you have a monoalphabetic substitution. There's a technique called alphabetic chaining. Anyway, there's a whole list of techniques, none of which are terribly useful now, but they're all very interesting, and if you want to have a nice holiday vacation, take along one of the old books on cryptanalysis and manual ciphers. Okay, so the response to this was, nuts. The problem is really in these frequency counts. So people develop polygraphic substitutions. Polygraphic substitutions take two letters and map them into two different letters. And the, if you take one letter at a time, it doesn't always go into the same letter, obviously. So here's one called the Playfair cipher, and I forgot what letter they threw away, probably J. This is probably the Latin, you know, the Caesar one. And so if you want to encrypt TH, you find T and you find H, and you look at the corresponding letters in the rectangle. Okay, and that's and that will hide, this frequency problem. So, to do a multi-alphabetic substitution is really easy. You just use this index coincidence test to try all possible columns. If it's a direct standard alphabet, you pretty much just have to pin down the E. And if you're in a bad, if things go bad for you, maybe one of the other popular letters. In polygraphic substitution, you have to compile bigraph frequencies, and you'll need a lot more text to do that. Again, it's the same mechanical operation. Here's another way people did this. It's called the Hill cipher, and what they basically, instead of using a grill, what Hill did, and we're actually already in the 1920s, is he said, look, I'm going to represent the plain text as a number between 0 and 25 inclusive. A is 0, B is 1, you know, C is 2. And I'm going to apply a matrix operation. So, plain text letter 1, plain text letter 2. I apply that matrix operation, which here I call K11, K12, K21, K22, blah, blah, and I'll get corresponding ciphertext letters. I do this all mod 26. Okay? Now, it's actually better to do it mod either 27 or mod 25, because as we all know, modular arithmetic mod 26, pure arithmetic mod 26 doesn't form a field. It can't because it's A times B. So you have to do something more sophisticated. It turns out there are finite fields, things that correspond to rational numbers, and there are finite fields of size 27, because 27 is 3 cubed. All the finite fields are a power of a prime. And there's a finite field of size 25. So you either throw out a letter, like the Romans did, throw out J, or you add a space, and you can apply the Hill cipher. Okay, I'm not really going to go into a long discussion about how you would break polygraphic ciphers with just ciphertext. You can do it. It's not very hard. But the key thing here is if you have two in a Hill cipher or a plain Playfair cipher, if you have two corresponding plain text letters, you can, right? You can, or several sets of them, you can break the cipher easily because you can discover the matrix. Okay, and again, the matrix is the key. The inverse matrix is the way you decode. So again, despite the fact that the multigraphic substitution hid frequency characteristics, with corresponding plain and ciphertext, it's still pretty easy to break these ciphers. Now I guess I'm going to talk a little bit about information theory, but if we have to cut this short, we will. So the question people use in old-fashioned ciphers is, how much information is in a text, piece of text? That often helps you determine what the text is. So there's a game you can play. You probably played it when you was a kid. And it says, you know, guess a number between 0 and 63, and you get six chances to guess the number. You get to ask me six questions. And the way you did it was, okay, is that you break it in half. You do binary search. But here's an easier way to break it. And it sort of indicates the amount of information content in that game. You say, listen, you want me to pick a number between 0 and 63? Yeah. Okay, write it down as a binary number. Okay, it has six digits, right? Bits, I guess, the binary representation. Is the first bit 1? If you answer yes, I put a 1 down. If you answer no, I put a 0 down. Is the second bit 1? Yes. So after six questions, I have the number in binary representation. So in some sense, that number between 0 and 63 contain n bits, n binary digits of information. In order to find out the value of that number, I had to ask you six questions because there was six bits of information. Six yes-no questions. Right? Okay. So people tried to generalize this idea, and this came up in coding theory, error correcting codes, and it's quite useful in cryptography also. And it's, what's the information content that's derived from a random source? That sounds different from what I just said with the n bits, but it's the same thing. If I ask you, what's the amount of information you need to determine a random number selected from 0 to 63, it's 6 bits if everything is equally probable. If all those numbers are equally probable. It's not the same thing if the numbers are not equally probable. So people try to discover, so for example, if only one letter will ever occur, you don't need any bits of information. You know the answer. If only two letters occur, you only need to distinguish between those two letters. Okay? So the information content has to do with properties of the source producing the message. And people tried to discover a quantitative measure of that. And Shannon did. He used it first in coding theory. And this was like in the 1940s. Later, in the later 40s, he actually developed a theory of cryptography based on it. And actually, I will quote the reference here. It's on the web. But it's actually quite useful information theory. Let's actually look at just a couple of quick examples from information theory. It'll help us do a couple things. So, whoops, sorry, I got to define. It turns out that if X is an information source and X can take on N values, the information content of that random source is the sum over each of those possibilities of minus the probability of that letter or that thing that came out times the log. LG means log base 2. Incidentally, always when I write LG, I mean log base 2, the log of that probability. And so just this measure of information content was useful for several reasons, or natural. First of all, as I'll show you in a minute, it corresponds, if you have an n-bit number and all those numbers are equally probable, it turns out that the answer, h of x will be n bits. So it's nice that the definition follows that. It also has this property. Okay, if you have the information content of a sequence which produces 1, 1 third, 1 sixth is the same as the one which produces that times the probability of which one is the 1 third, 1 sixth times the information content of discriminating between the 1 third case and the 1 sixth case. So that's a good property. Here's the reference for the Shannon paper for communication theory of secrecy systems. So again, entropy, equivocation, this is also called, is the amount of uncertainty present in the message. The amount of information you learn by seeing a message is the amount of uncertainty you had before you saw something minus the information you had after you saw something. So the information, let's imagine Y is a key. So the uncertainty in the key before you made an observation minus the entropy in the uncertainty in the key given a single plain text ciphertext message. So in manual ciphers, actually this provides some useful information. So for key management, here's a mathematical way. You know, if you have an n-bit key, your intuition is that, you know, probably the safest thing is to assign keys, pick a key at random and everything be equally probable. Here's a way to see that that's the best way to do it. Here are some distributions. The first distribution is there's a 2-bit key. Each of the four possibilities in the 4-2-bit key are equally likely. There's a 4-bit key, and each of the 16 possible keys are equally likely. Here's a final distribution if you have an n-bit key, and each of the 2 to the n-bit possibilities are equally likely. Okay, by contrast, I'll pick some bad or less good distributions. Here's a 2-bit key, and the distribution of the probability of each of those values is 1/2 for the first value, and then 1/6 for each of the next three values. Okay, and then I pick two other distributions. I'm not going to berate this. But if you apply that function I described earlier, h of x equals the sum from I equals 1 to n of p of I log base 2 of I, here's what you get for the uncertainty in that 2-bit key, all of which things are equally likely. 1 half times log 4 plus 1 quarter times log 4, blah, 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 blah. Log base 2 of 4 is 2. If you multiply this out, you get 2 bits. So for 2 bits, you get 2 bits of information, which makes perfect sense. For the equally likely case of 4 bits, for 4, if they're all equal, you have 4 bits of information. So there's 4 bits of uncertainty when you've picked a key from a sample set with equal probability. And then for an n-bit thing, you get n bits of information. That's the goal. You want the adversary to have the worst possible uncertainty in your key. Okay. By contrast, if you do that calculation with the asymmetric probability distribution, suppose I pick key number 1 with probability 1 half instead of probability 1 quarter, there's only 1.79 bits of information. And what that means is when you do a key search strategy, you'll start with that highly probable key. And on average, you'll have to look at less than 4 keys, and which means you have less than 2 bits of information. The information, that second distribution where the first thing was 1 half and then the 15 other ones had lower probability, you have 2.95 bits instead of 4 bits. Yes?
Is this related to the same kind of issue that recently occurred with discovering MD5 and the way the spread of the space wasn't uniform?
No, but we'll talk about why that.
Okay.
What happened. Yeah. What happened there? That's a different issue. And then finally, an n-bit thing. Okay? So I'm going to skip that. Here's how you can use it to help your Bunning cryptanalysis. It turns out that if you apply this h function to a random string of 26 letters, 26 equally probable letters, it turns out the information content is 4.7. Okay? If you apply that measure to a group of English words, you can look at it in more detail, it turns out the information content is this, a smaller number. This is what, remember I said earlier, English is about is redundant by factor 4. This is what? This is actually helpful in breaking ciphers because not all possible combination of letters will make a sensible English sentence or word or anything, right? Only a quarter of them, roughly, in some sense, will. Yes?
John, I think you're missing N. Is in the case if you have a string of N,
yes,
letters, it's 4.7 N bits.
Yeah, yeah. So, in fact, if you calculate H for a one-letter distribution with the frequency, you'll get a number less than B. So what I did, that's why I sort of stuttered before, you actually look at a string of N English letters and you calculate the joint probability. And that's a smaller number because there's inter-symbol dependencies.
This is a really key point. If you choose, a password out of an English word, the actual entropy inside that password is less than the number of characters in that password. Okay? You may only get 1.2 to 1.5 bits per character. So, 10 character password would be that many bits, actually, if you know what you're doing.
Yeah, so, and again, just by contrast, if you calculated H for single letter English distributions, which is perfectly in your power to do, I gave you the list of single letter frequencies, you will get a number, you'll get a different number. This is sort of the take a whole string and do a probability for all of English, so you get a different number. Okay, so this is interesting, and it bears on a question somebody asked me earlier. It turns out not all possible decrypts of something make sense. So one way to decrypt an English sentence, so it turns out another way of writing that H of R is that for an n-letter text, there are approximately 2 to the nh, where h is the entropy of English, texts that really are English. And everything else is not English, it's gibberish. Okay? So one way to sort of automatically decode things is to pick keys and see if they fall into the part of the reception space that makes sense or not space sense. So let's say a quarter of the messages make sense and three quarters don't make sense. So I try a key, it falls into the one quarter space. So I say, you know what, that means there's a good chance that that was English. And I keep doing this for many texts. The probabilities multiply. At some point, if I have enough text, there only will be one possible key that decodes the text into reasonable English. That's called the unicity distance. And with this mechanism, you can actually, I'm going to skip that, calculate that. It turns out, here's the thing I was describing. In a ciphertext message, I can have the alphabet size. This is an alphabet. And I have an n-bit message. And if it were not English, everything could move around with equal probability. But since I know the decode is English, I have a much smaller set of meaningful texts. And so it turns out I can calculate the unicity distance. So the log of the number of possible keys divided by the log of the size of the alphabet minus the entropy. If you divide those two numbers, you'll get the number of letters approximately that will cause a unique decode. And that's approximately the number of letters you need for a ciphertext-only analysis of an English text. So in very particular, if you have a monoalphabetic substitution where you have the 26 letters and you're willing to permute them all around, not do the direct standard thing I did, but you're really willing to permute the letters, even with ciphertext only, it only takes about 25 letters before you get a unique decode. Now, if I have only 8 to 10 symbols of corresponding planar ciphertext, I can break it. So this is actually almost the only place where we have good quantitative numbers. It takes roughly 2.5 times as much stuff if you have corresponding plain ciphertext than if you had just ciphertext in this example to break a cipher.
Is that 25n? So that's like 25 times the size of the ciphertext? Is that what you mean?
No. So if, to be very concrete, suppose I encrypted something with a monoalphabetic substitution, but unlike the examples I gave, I'm really willing to mix up all the letters. If I give you a 25-letter ciphertext, but it's English, it came from English, the plain text, it's quite likely you'll be able to figure out the plain text. If I give you 20, you might have some problems. Now, if I give you corresponding eight letters or 10 letters of corresponding plain and ciphertext, and then I give you another ciphertext, you've got a pretty good shot of breaking that one too. And these actually, the people who have did this for a living, it's actually remarkably close to what the actual experience was in doing this. Okay. Another example of this is we can prove, I'm not going to go through the proof, but you can actually use this mechanism to prove that the one-time pad with purely random input is perfectly secure. And by that, by this measure, it means an adversary with unlimited computational resources cannot discriminate, cannot obtain any information from the ciphertext. Again, as I said, the poor one-time pad has other problems, but this is one of the few cases we have a nice concrete result about the security of a symmetric cipher, of a secret key cipher. I'm really not going to go through this any much because I want to give you a break, but the point of this is there's a very, very big difference between ciphers which are immune from ciphertext-only attacks, known ciphertext plaintext attacks, and chosen cipher plaintext attacks. And for all these manual ciphers, they're almost trivially breakable under corresponding known ciphertext attacks. Okay. We have an hour. We're mostly going to spend the next hour talking about DES. But so what lesson did Shannon actually learn from this? Aside from the mathematics of entropy, he also learned that you could mix two cryptographic elements and get a much more secure cipher than either of them separately. And if you mix in a lot of these together, you got a pretty strong cipher. Now, in these old-fashioned manual ciphers, the mixing elements consist of transpositions, which introduce something we call diffusion, and you'll see that term later, because the information moves around within the block. It diffuses within the block. And then substitution, which introduces confusion. It changes the identity of letters. It turns out that you can actually build a quite pretty good cipher if you alternate transpositions and substitutions, and transpositions and substitutions. Now, in manual ciphers, that's hard to do automatically, but that's the idea for building secure symmetric ciphers. They will mix these two cipher elements, which are relatively weak, as I've shown you, independently. But when you do enough of them in order and mix them properly, you actually get a comparatively strong cipher. It turns out that that's how DES and many of these other ciphers are done, and I will continue this at 8:37. Okay, I'm going to... I had a section on mechanical ciphers that I'm going to cover in 8 minutes. And so you're not going to get much, but just so you understand the historical progression here. So the manual ciphers, the main problem is humans are bad at doing repetitious stuff. And so if I build a good manual cipher out of substitutions, which are keyed in some ways, people will make mistakes, they'll have trouble. A machine doesn't. So the next progression of what happened in ciphers, which lasted all the way into the 60s, really until digital computers became fairly cheap, were cipher machines. There were simple manual machines. Actually, a president, back when presidents were smarter, actually invented one, a Jefferson cipher. Actually, there's a president in the 1800s who had an independent proof of Pythagoras' theorem. That's all changed. his teammates.
Yeah, seriously, you had to be handsome and be...
Yeah, that's right. During World War II, there are a bunch of rotor machines, and I'll explain briefly the rotor principle that were used to generate many alphabets. Enigma was the famous German one that was broken. Hebron was done actually during the 20s, which was the granddaddy. Sigaba was our machine, the US-UK machine. I'm sorry, the US machine. Typex was the UK machine. They were very similar. There was a machine based on stepping switches that the Japanese used called Purple. And then there was one that was used even through the Korean War, an M209, which was based on a mechanical lug cage thing. Here's the Jefferson cipher. Somebody asked, are there ciphers where a single piece of plain text can go into multiple cipher texts or vice versa? This is it. A Jefferson cipher, you had many cipher wheels with the alphabets permuted, and you lined up the wheels so your message, you know, read across one of the rows, like, don't listen to Washington, he's a liar. And then you twisted the machine and you picked any of the 25 other rows as the ciphertext. It was nice in the sense that human beings could quickly recognize the English when they turned it, but it confused the frequency counts. The Enigma machine, which you can see in the museum, in the NSA museum, I've seen it at other museums also, and there's a bunch of online demos of it, was based on, I'll show you the design, rotors, where letters were represented by signals which were permuted by these rotors. And then the rotors would change, which presumably made them hard to solve. It turns out, and we're not going to see why, is if you know an itsy-bitsy-bitsy bit of group theory, a cipher like Enigma, which seems like a horribly complicated cipher that generates, you know, thousands and thousands of alphabets, you can discover the elementary cryptographic elements, the rotors, and then slide them against each other. And there's a very interesting group theory that sort of problem that sort of cuts to the heart of this, and I won't have a chance to explain it, but here's what an Enigma machine looks like mechanically. There are three movable rotors, which have contacts on each case, 26 contacts on each side, corresponding to letters, and they're all wired differently, each of the rotors. Then there's a fixed rotor on the end called something in German, which I won't try to pronounce, but it's the reflecting rotor. It stays fixed. And then there's, in the newer Enigma, in the later Enigma, there was a stecker or a key or plug board, which allowed you to make fixed substitutions. This was actually quite important later in the war. And the way something was encrypted is you'd hit a letter on the keyboard that I showed you, and the signal would flow in through the corresponding letter contact. It would go through the first letter, first rotor, and get moved around somewhere. And then it would go through the second rotor and get moved around somewhere. And then through the third rotor, and it would move around somewhere. And then it would go through the unpronounceable German thing and get reflected into something and go back through another chain. Okay? And then it would come back through the lamp lights, and the light would light up for the corresponding thing. And it was a beautifully made machine. And the rotors, after you encrypted one letter, would change. The fastest rotor, this one, would change after the first letter. And after 26 letters, not only would this change, but the next rotor would change. So it would generate a huge number of alphabets, which made people think it was secure. So the first lesson here is, don't believe you're secure because you have a lot of alphabets. Anyway, it turns out the key for solving rotor is group theory, which is why I told you about it in the first place. And Here's the actual Enigma data. I'm going to rush because in 2 minutes I got to have been done. It actually describes all the possible rotors and the reflectors that existed and when the keys turned. The other thing is, if you look at the Enigma machine, there's actually tons and tons of key information. So big keys don't necessarily make strong ciphers. If you look at the Enigma and you count up the uncertainty in all the components, like how each rotor is wired and all that, you end up with an astounding 312 bits of key information. This, and you know, by contrast, AES, typically people use it with a 128-bit key. But AES is vastly more secure than this, despite the fact that it has an enormous key space, because there was a break in it that, you know, this clever idea with group theory lets you discover the underlying cryptographic elements easily.
Yes. Maybe be the relationship between the rotors, something like that. There's more.
It turns out the rotors don't hide the cyclic structure of the permutation. They hide the letters, not the cyclic structure. And then when you put the stecker in, it makes things worse. But the relationship of the cipher letters, they basically have the same shape. I know that's real artsy, craftsy, high level, but that's the deal. Some invariant is preserved that lets you reduce the key search vastly. And there are lots of good books on this. One of my favorite is Budinsky. I found the name of the book, but there are a bunch of books. There's a code book by Singh. There's a book called The Pleasures of Counting that describes the Enigma break. There are millions of them. Okay. Also, the Germans, it turned out, the Enigma with good key hygiene would have been relatively safe, but they did some stupid things. And the second lesson, if we got to go through this, is don't do stupid things when you key. They had a good reason for doing the stupid things, but it still turned out to be stupid. And I won't go through this. It was basically broken by some Poles who had a little bit corresponding plain ciphertext, and it was, you know, a pretty amazing thing the way they broke it. And it's outlined here. And for extra credit, you can solve one of the problems. It's actually the discovery of how this happened is very interesting. Okay, but I'm not going to get to talk to you much more about mechanical ciphers, because we're actually interested in computers and computer ciphers. What we learned from the last hour was, in order to build a secure cipher, you wanted a complicated keyed invertible function, something that produced a permutation that was constructed from elementary round operations whose elements were confusion, changing things, diffusion, spreading out the information within the message, and key mixing. And you'll see why that's important. You can actually build a very safe cipher based on this. They're fast, they typically are used to encrypt things of block size, you know, 64, 128 bits. The watershed for this was DES, which was designed in 1974 by IBM. This was the first really pretty good commercial cipher. And the history was, there was a 1972 study, NIST issued an RFP, NSA is alleged to have some blocks, some influence on the S-box, and as far as I can tell, if they influenced the S-box, they made it much better. Unfortunately, they reduced the key size, which made it much worse, but on balance, it seemed like somebody knew what they were doing. When you signed the S-boxes, it was published, established as a standard and used in the federal, published in the Federal Register in 375, published in the Phipps publication in 1976, and it's what everybody used up to about 3-4 years ago, really. Yeah. It's a descendant of a cipher by Horst Feistel called Lucifer, and I'll describe that cipher and how it changed. And here are the designers. The real problem, although DES did teach us how to break ciphers, and the two key techniques were linear and differential cryptanalysis, which you'll learn in a few weeks, it was basically a well-designed cipher, and its basic weakness was its key was too small. It eventually became susceptible to exhaustive key search. But other than that, it was pretty darn good. Here's how Lucifer worked. What Lucifer did was took a key, the key, and manufactured lots of subkeys from that key, and it had fixed substitution boxes. So there was this S1, S0, which would take 4 bits in, and depending on the key, make one of two substitutions. So this was the first cryptographic element called a substitution box. Then the output, each of these 4-bit outputs, was permuted by a fixed permutation. And again, this is the diffusion element. Then the next, so there's a round key in here, which I'll just call R key, which decided whether S0 or S1 was picked for the substitution. And then you do this, and I've forgotten how many rounds. Does it say here? It says 8 rounds. But you do this 8 times. And after about 2 or 3 rounds, statistics were gone. And the output was the decrypted plaintext. To invert this transformation, you just ran it backwards. You had the key schedule, and you ran it backwards. Everything worked fine. DES took Lucifer and did something better. And the reasons it did it were actually quite complicated. In order to have a good confusion function, it has to set this F, the ugly function you're about to see in a minute, it has to have a number of properties. For binary functions, it turns out they have to be nonlinear and have a bunch of properties. For 2, 3, 4 bit functions, it's hard to find good nonlinear functions. Many of them are what were called affinely equivalent to each other. So they allow this linear cryptanalysis. Turns out at around 6 letters, you can really start picking good S-boxes. You can do this. And around 8 bits of input, pretty much you can pick the functions at random, and you're in great shape. So DES was built on an iterated cipher, just at Lucifer, but the rounds were a little bit different. Okay, so here's the basic DES cipher. You get plain text 64 bits in, you get ciphertext 64 bits out. You have a key, which is in this case 56 bits, and each key is run through a key scheduling algorithm that produces 16 separate 48-bit keys, which are used in the individual round functions. I'll tell you how those key bits are derived in a minute. But
that's deterministic. That's deterministic. The key schedule is deterministic.
Yes, absolutely. Everything is deterministic. The only thing non-deterministic is the key, which, again, we want to have entropy, what? 56 bits. Okay. So that's actually the overall structure of the cipher. I need to tell you about what a single round is, and that will tell you. Here's a single round, and this was a beautiful idea. Incidentally, Horst Feistel was not a government cryptographer. He got interested in cryptography doing identification of friend and foe systems in MITRE. He would have never got away with doing this research at the time, probably, if he was working for an organization and thought he wanted to use it in a real cipher. Because at the time, it was you know, the government was sensitive about people printing good ciphers. But he was in a sort of peripheral area. In IFF systems, cryptography, basically the way you identify a friend or foe, you just say, here's a random number, fighter jet, over there. If you encrypt it with the same key I have, I'll know you're a friend. Otherwise, you're a foe, because you don't know the key. So it was a useful thing. Okay, so here was Feistel's basic round. What he did is took the 64-bit input and chopped it into two 32-bit blocks. Okay? And he applied two transformations in succession. First, he had a highly nonlinear function called f, and the input to that nonlinear function was the key for that round, and the right-hand side, these are usually called L and R, of the, you know, the right 32 bits of the input block. That the output of this was XORed with the left-hand block. Okay? And then the left-hand block, the second transformation, was to transpose the right-hand block and the left-hand block. So the basic round of DES was two functions. A function sigma sub I, which depends on the key, which takes 32 bits and 32 bits, and all it does... forget that I actually put the details of the function in here, but you don't need to know it. It actually XORs the cryptographic, the F, what Josh would call the ugly function, with the left-hand side. And the second operation transposes the two sides. Incidentally, let's look at two interesting things. If I apply each of these transformations twice in a row, I get the identity. In other words, if I take the left-hand block, XOR this F function, then XOR it again, I get L back again. So sigma sub I has the very interesting property that if you apply sigma sub I twice, you get the identity. It's an involution. The transposition where you move the left-hand side to the right-hand side is also a transposition. If I move a left-hand side to a right-hand side and take the result and move the left-hand side to the right-hand side, I get the same thing back. So the basic operation of a single round of DES is two involutions, which is fascinating. They build a strong cipher out of the simplest kind of group theory thing you could find, and that's an involution. Okay? Here's the actual function, the F, the ugly part. And what you do is you take 32 bits of input, the input from the last round, and you expand it to a 48-bit quantity by copying some of the bits over. Okay? Then you XOR in the 48-bit round key. So that's how you introduce key mixing. Then you take successive 6 bits of this 48-bit quantity, and there are 8 of those, and you put them through a substitution box, which takes a 6-bit input and gives you a 4-bit output. Okay? So now you have 4 times 8, or 32 bits of output. And then finally, what you do is you take the output of the substitution boxes and you permute the bits around in a fixed way. P is known, these are all known. That's a round. Again, it's easy to invert. Yes?
Tell me again how you put 6 bits in and get 4 bits out.
So the substitution, basically, it's a lookup table. You can think of it as a lookup table. There are 2 to the 6th entries, and each entry has 4 bits. It's a 4-bit number.
Won't there be collisions?
Huh?
Won't there be collisions?
You don't care about collisions. That's okay. They're definitely... In fact, there'll be collisions. So for each Xbox, there'll be 4 of the... each value will come out 4 times, depending on the 6 bits. As you'll see in a minute, the data... I'll show you some of the data for DES. Okay? And you combine two rounds in the easiest possible way, is you take the output of one round and just feed it to the next round. Okay, so there are simple ways to defeat statistics. You've got to be careful of a few things when you design a cipher like this, even right off the top of your head. The isolated cipher like this, you can pick Fs that so that the statistics, in other words, if you look at the dependency of the input to the output, they disappear in about four rounds. That's pretty easy. You've got to watch out that the key bits get mixed properly with the plain text bits. Here's an attack that can happen if they don't get mixed well. Suppose you can write suppose you can write a constraint equation. Suppose you can figure out an equation where if you have a matrix and you have corresponding plain and ciphertext, and then you have coefficients. And suppose that coefficients, which may, you know, depend on lots of stuff, constrain what a key bit is. Make the key bit satisfy this binary equation. For each one of these equations you get, let's say a 56-bit key, let's say you have 26 of these equations. You can guess 26 bits at random, and the other 26 bits you use this equation, you really only have to search a space of 2 to the 28 to do a clever exhaustive search of the DES space this way. If key bits only affect a few, only are used to affect a few cipher bits, so for example, suppose you can write a matrix so that some arbitrary function, I don't really care what it is of the key bits, times the first bit of the cipher plus some other function times the second plain text bit. Suppose you can write an equation like this. So the cipher text is a matrix times the plain text cipher bits. Okay? If I have n equations and n unknowns, I can solve for these coefficients, f1, f12, f2. Right? They're n squared of those. So if I have a little bit more than n squared corresponding plain and cipher text, without finding the key, I can find this this matrix. That would let me break the cipher without finding a key. I'm not saying this happens in DES, but here's the kinds of things you have to worry about. In particular, a very bad thing to do is if you make that function linear. If you make that f function linear, you're guaranteed to have the ciphertext be a linear function of the keys and the plaintext. And it's easy to find those constraint equations. It's totally trivial. And there's a big difference with solving 64 independent linear equations, which takes linear time in 64, roughly, and having to try 2 to the 64 combinations. Big, big, big difference. Okay, I already told you this, and I don't want to tell you that, so let's actually look at the structure. DS is a tiny itsy-bitsy bit more complicated than what I just said, but it turns out to be insignificant. So the input, which is 64 bits, is first permuted by an initial permutation before this multi-round transformation takes place. It turns out that's cryptographically insignificant. You can always, you know, the initial permutation. So if you're the adversary, that didn't hide anything. I said each round was a combination of this thing where you XORed something with the left-hand side and then transpose the left-hand to right-hand side. That's almost true. In the last round, you don't transpose the left-hand side and the right-hand side. It's fairly trivial. And again, if you were an adversary and you knew the structure, you would know about that transposition, so it doesn't add anything. And then finally, the output bits are permuted by this, by the inverse of the permutation of the input bits. To invert this, you just run the function reverse. In other words, instead of applying the key schedule with key 1 first, you apply key 16 first. That'll get you back to the thing that came into key 16. Then key 15, then key 14, then key 13, and eventually you get the same text back. Again, the function was, because you had this nice transposition structure, you automatically got an invertible transformation that was very easy to mechanize. It's really a beautiful idea. The most beautiful part of the idea is no matter how horribly ugly that f function is, that the transformation, the sigma sub I, which is the L XOR the F, is always an involution. Okay, here's another symbolic way to look at the permutation. I explained this in my thing. You have a take the right input, the right 32 bits. You run this expansion matrix, which produces a 40-bit, 8-bit version of the input. You XOR that with the key schedule. You apply each of the you can't see when I do the that thing. You apply each of the X boxes in succession. Each of the X boxes produces a 4-bit output. You permute it, and there you are. You've got the output of the little f function. Okay, you'll be able to do that. One of your programs is to go through that for two rounds of DES. And it's not at all hard, so don't be worried.
What's the point of the expansion from 32 to 48 bits?
There are two reasons, but the main reason has to do with the fact that, in fact, they're on the border. It's very hard to get good nonlinear 4-bit transformations, so the input transformation had to be about 6 bits. They didn't have big enough ROMs to do 6-bit to 6-bit transformations, which would have been perfectly fine, incidentally, but you know, that was an engineering trade-off. But they knew to do a good job, they had to have about 6 bits of input to the X boxes to make the confusion function highly nonlinear in several ways, which I'll explain in a minute. I'll tell you the key round transformation, but you don't have to know this in great detail. What they do is broke the key into, it was again 56 bits, 228-bit quantities. They would left shift these quantities in place and then use a permutation permutation to select 48 bits out of it. Then the next round they'd shift it again, use that same permutation to select 48 bits out. The shifts were irregular. It wasn't the same shift at every round, as I think the next slide, well, one of the slides soon says. So that's how they did the key schedule. The key schedule was a little bit of a weaker part of DES, actually. We learned a lot more about key schedule. Here is DES described algebraically, which is the other reason I told you the group theory. If really, DES is nothing but the product of 31 involutions, 16 of which are key dependent. So this is the transposition, the thing that turns LR into RL, and these are the key-dependent transformations. It has a beautiful algebraic structure, and in fact, you might think this algebraic structure helps you break it, but oh no. Although it does have an effect on the text. Here, I'm not going to go through the key schedule. Here's the irregular key schedule. It turns out, if you pick the same rotation each time, you have trouble. There are related key attacks, and the key schedule in DES apparently was picked with the knowledge of some of these attacks, although they didn't do a great job on that. It could have been more regular, it could have been more mixing, but there we go. The permuted choice in the key schedule is here. This doesn't really necessarily mean anything to you. This is how the key bits for each round were picked out of the 42. I wanted to provide all the DES data for you so you'd have a good idea. In the references, you can go to the original FIPS publications. It's FIPS 46. It's in the reference to see the actual literal description. I also put a website that takes you through DES round by round, so you can see a particular encryption.
Where is that?
It's in the notes here. This is just a bunch of data. These are the key bits in the first round schedule. So key bit number 10 is the first bit in the first round. You can go through and compute all these. Here are the substitution boxes. Now, actually, what happened to substitution box 1? Wow, I omitted a slide, I think.
Page 92. Let's get slide 92, John.
How did I do that? Yeah, okay, well, the slides are out of order. There's the first 3S boxes. Here's the permutation, the key that moves the output of the rounds around. And I actually should make, since one of your homework problems is to do a round of DES, let me warn you of one thing. So the S boxes are arranged in rows. Each row has all 16 possible values. So for a 6-bit input, here's how you calculate the output of an S box. You take the first bit, of the 6-bit and the last bit of the, this is documented in the standard, so it'll work. The first bit and the last bit, that's a 2-bit number, that selects the row. Then you take the 4-bit number that's left, the 4 bits that are left, that's a value between 0 and 15, that selects the column. Okay? So you got to be a little bit careful, they're not in order. You know, it's not just a 64 bits worth of 4-bit values, and I'm sorry, 64 values of 4-bit quantities, and you apply it in order. You have to remember that little trick.
And so someone just concocted these Xboxes?
Well, it's not just concocted. For reasons I'll show you later, there was a fair amount of thought that had to go into this. As I said, if these were linear functions, they would have been SOL. That would have been easy to break. Oh, cryptographic hash. Let me go back and show you in some ways. Here are the two, actually, as it turns out. I don't know how this got to page 92, but here are the two references. Go look at the first one, assuming it's still online, and it was, takes you through an encryption round by round. This is quite useful. And the second one is the official publication, which is reasonably well written. NIST has actually done a pretty good job in cryptography, in my opinion. And one of the evidences is their standards. Anyway. So you said, well, how did they pick them? There are a lot of things. So they couldn't be linear. Here's, I don't expect you to know this. Any function in a field can be written as a polynomial, as it turns out. It's called Lagrange interpolation theorem. Here is here's the first Xbox, the S1, the first bit of it, written as a polynomial. And what this means, I have to explain it to you. This means bit 5 times bit 6, XORed with bit 4, XORed with bit 3, and bit 5. They're horribly long polynomials. If you try to write out an algebraic expression with these polynomials, of the you get an explosion in the terms. Way too many terms for you to solve algebraically, which defeats one of those two attacks I told you about with the matrices. So it was carefully chosen not only to be highly nonlinear, that is, it's distant, it's far away from a linear function, but the polynomials representation is pretty complicated, pretty big mess.
Sorry, I don't see how this is a polynomial.
So if I have six, let's do it with 2 bits. I'll show you a 2-bit polynomial. The 2 bits, this is the x1 bit, this is the x2 bit. Here's the only nonlinear function, the only inequivalent nonlinear function for 2 bits. It's x1 times x2. So the value of this function is 0 unless both x1 and x2 are 1. Okay? Here's another nonlinear one. It's linearly equivalent to this. So you multiply x1 times x2, and then you XOR, plus is XOR in the GF2 case, the second, whatever I said, the first bit 1 again. So you can, all these, you can think of a block, any bit of n bits, as an element of a finite field of 2 to the n elements. Or you can look at it as a linear vector space over, n things. So anyway, that's the polynomial representation. So no, they weren't picked at random. In fact, they seem to be picked at least to guard against one particular attack, the differential attack.
And these are these coefficients, those numbers?
No, these, I'm sorry, this shorthand, I guess, is, I'll write the first few terms of what this means. So again, the bits are x1, x2, x3, x4, x5, x6. That's the input to the Xbox. So I'll write the first two terms. It's x5 times x6 plus XOR, x4, XOR, x2, oops, sorry, x3. See, I did it out of order. I should. X5 times x6, XOR x4, x3 times x5, XOR x2, XOR x2 times x6. You get the idea? That's the polynomial representation. So again, if you substituted those letters in here, you would get the same value as if you did the table lookup.
Yeah. What is C then?
C, yes. Thank you very much for asking. These are all variables. It turns out there's one constant that you might add. If you add 0, it won't appear, but you might XOR the constant 1 in. When you see a C here, that means that polynomial has a constant of 1 in addition. So you would, after all this crap, you'd XOR in a 1.
So what does the GF mean? Is that something field?
Yeah, Galois field with two elements.
Okay.
What's the advantage of representing it in this form? I mean, this form is equivalent to the box.
It is. There's not an advantage in this form. It turned out if these were very simple, it would introduce an attack. The fact that they're horribly complicated like this means somebody... You can even have nonlinear functions which have relatively simple polynomial representations. These don't. Yes?
So you said you're XOR 1 at the end. Are we going from the right to the left?
Well, for the 1, it doesn't matter.
Well, yeah, yes. I know, but, like...
Yeah, so I was counting the bits from the left.
Okay, so, yeah. Like, if we were to do this, we would still be going left to right.
Yes.
Okay.
So why not have a simple representation, X1, X2, X3, something like that, I don't know.
And use polynomials instead of the... It's easier to implement the round lookup. It only takes order one time for the lookup. So it's easier mechanically to store the substitution box in a ROM instead of having discrete logic to do the polynomials. Although, again, in nonlinear shift registers, back before they had big ROMs, this is how they'd do it. They'd actually describe the polynomial.
We're talking polynomial like this for every...
For every one of the 32-bit positions. And they're not ugly, they're beautiful. No matter what Josh says. Okay. So that's DES. And so it turns out DES is a great example of constructing a complicated, very secure cipher. And you're going to learn in great detail why, in two lectures, three lectures, whatever it is, why it's secure. I actually worked on breaking DES. Some of the first linear cryptanalysis stuff was stuff we did at Bell Labs. And it was amazing. Every time you changed part of a DES box, it made some attack easier. So I actually admired the way these S boxes were constructed. Now again, technology has changed. It's a lot easier to develop 8-bit S boxes than 6-bit S boxes. But there you go. Yeah.
All these S-boxes, were they published from the DES?
Yes, everything is published. The principle I said originally still holds with DES. The whole algorithm is known. The only secret for you is the key. Yeah.
Wasn't there a lot of concern, though, on the part of government that this stuff was being published and it was...
We should put that off for the last class. I only have 15 minutes to do cryptographic hashes. Sure. Yeah, there's tons of controversy around this. First, there's controversy, did NSA actually make the cipher weaker? Maybe we shouldn't export strong crypto because bad guys will be able to conceal. There's all kinds of stuff. Let's not talk about it now, although it's all fascinating. NSA is actually... at the time, was kind of tended to be restricted, and recently has been pretty good, actually, in my opinion, about supporting this. Anyway, so that's a basic block cipher, and it turns out the progression to make them stronger is exactly the progression I told you about with the manual ciphers. People developed a couple of attacks, and the next round of ciphers, AES, which was again was a pretty good example of NIST opening a public competition, which was well supported by the cryptographic community, developed a new standard. Those ciphers are all built on these same design principles. Multi-round, key mixing at one point, confusion at the next part, diffusion at another part, redo, shake and bake. So this was a pretty big breakthrough, at least in unclassified symmetric ciphers.
For each round, are those 8 S boxes the same? Like
yep, same in each round. The only thing that changes is the key mixing and then the permutation.
Right.
And you can imagine with the permutation and the key mixing, very soon by the fourth round, each output involves each of the key bits each of the plain text bits in some horrible nonlinear way.
I think so.
Huh? Gorgeous. what more could you ask for? Okay. So that's block ciphers. We're going to go in more detail about how you would attack block ciphers and all that stuff in a couple of lectures. But Brian's going to talk about protocols, which depend on two things, three things possibly, depending on the protocol. It will depend on a public key mechanism, and Josh is going to talk about that next class, a cryptographic hash, which I'm just about to explain, and possibly a symmetric key. Most of the protocols you negotiate a symmetric key, and then you're all off and running. Okay. The reason it's in the same lecture as symmetric key ciphers is all the mechanisms to attack symmetric key ciphers are applicable to cryptographic caches. So they're very similar fields of study. So what's a cryptographic hash? And they're built the same way, in a multi-round, you know, something which mixes up stuff, produces and makes nonlinear substitution, and makes inverting very hard if you don't know something. In fact, in the cryptographic hash, you can know everything. It's a lot in words. So there we go. Okay, so cryptographic hash is a one-way function. I'm going to call it H. From all binary string lengths to a fixed binary string length. So what do I mean by a one-way function? If I tell you the output of the function applied to a string, I don't tell you the input, I tell you the output. You can't figure out what the input is in a computationally feasible way. You can't do it. That's what one-way means. So, and that's what this says. And these things are called one-way hash functions. Cryptographic hashes have an additional property, actually two, but one follows from the other, and that's called collision resistance. The collision resistant property says if I give you the output of a cryptographic hash, you can't find another number easily that hashes the same thing. Easily, I mean possibly, really, in a practical sense. That it takes much more work than you ever have time to do with all the computers in the world to find another thing that hashes to that same value. That's collision resistance. Both are important properties. Again, yeah.
That's even though the messages can be much larger than the block size.
Even though the messages can be much larger. So there obviously will be collisions. If I have, you know, again, a standard cryptographic hash, a SHA-1, has 160-bit output. And so I could put 2 megabytes in, and another 2 megabytes in, it's pretty clear I'm going to get collisions. But what I'll show you is that in a well-designed cryptographic hash will require you're doing, if it's 160 bits of output, 2 to the 80th, or roughly the square root of 2 to the 160th operations to find a collision, which is too much. Yeah.
And also isn't the principle that, like, messages end up producing wild.
That's right. Oh, well, that's a weakness. So.
Wait, that's good, right?
No, it's good, and that's why it's used. I'm about to show you why cryptographic caches are useful, and that's one of the useful things is that they spread stuff out. It turns out the best known attacks on cryptographic caches, which use differential cryptanalysis, display tiny itsy bitsy little places where that isn't quite true. And that's the basis of the attack. Just like symmetric ciphers, the measure of value is it should be really easy for you to compute the cryptographic hash and really hard to invert it. Like impossible with all the computers in the world for some fixed period of time, but, you know, for years, 5 years.
Well, hashes lose information.
They absolutely do.
So it should be impossible to invert it.
Well, when I say invert, I mean find any value that hashes to the same thing. You're right.
Okay.
You're right. Yeah. You're right. Okay. You can think of hashes as strong checksums, and I'll show you the applications, but they have a very interesting property that's different than most checksums. If you have checksum, which typically are, you know, cyclic redundancy check, that sort of stuff, it's very easy to find another value which has the same cyclic redundancy check. But it's almost impossible to find a cryptographic hash another value that hashes the same thing. So they're a good redundancy integrity mechanism. They're used for lots of applications like that. Despite the fact that they lose information, the chances that two values that collided by accident are like ridiculously small. One out of 2 to the 60th or 2 to the 80th or something. Like outside of the time you're worried. If you're worried about that, you've got more. You're a better person than me because I got more high probability bad things happening. Yeah.
Isn't that a good point that even if you find a vulnerability in one of these hashes, a lot of times in a lot of the applications I've seen them used for is this integrity checking.
Mm-hmm.
And it still is good for that even if you find some collision.
It's good, but you've got to be careful. And most you've got to keep the attack model in mind. It's good if you're looking for random changes. It's still good for that. The trouble is you have an adversary who, for some reason, wants you to think this hash thing is the same as this hash thing, and they get to pick that. So it's not, it's a non-trivial when these things collide. It's a big deal. If you can produce the collision.
Yeah, I was thinking in applications where you don't care about...
There are some, but they're typically not cryptographic applications.
So
for cryptographic hashes, we need both properties, the collision resistance and the one-way function. As you said, small changes should create large changes. If not, if small changes create small changes, you could pick a value, make small changes, and expect them to stay in a little neighborhood. And that would, that means you could find a collision easily. There are many popular, just like ciphers, most practical cryptographic hashes are not based on mathematical, on NP completeness results. They're based on the same stuff you saw with DES. You know, a ridiculous, well chosen, but ridiculously complicated multi-round transformation. The first popular cryptographic hashes were are now largely broken. MD4 and MD5 both have great weaknesses. SHA-1 is showing some signs of age. That's 160 bits. And for example, if you're at Microsoft, you're, for new applications, you're not supposed to use SHA-1. And then there's a new class of applications, the SHA-2 functions, which are both stronger and bigger, have are bigger size too. Yeah.
So broken in this context means being able to find
a collision. But typically, the attack is a collision.
Yeah. You had the paper that demonstrated the brain MD5 actually handed KB2 source and two inputs. So, you know, that's enough for this game.
Okay. So what are hashes good for? As you said, the first example is a strong checksum, sometimes called an unkeyed hash. That attack I mentioned on a stream cipher where somebody changes a bit, XORs in a bit, and they should pay them $1,000,035 instead of 35 cents, if you put an MDC in there, a dimension, you can check that nobody did that. Okay? So that's one application. A message authentication code, and I'll show you a really cool example of this at the end. If you have a secret key, you don't care whether the information is disclosed, but you want to make sure somebody can guarantee it came from you and it hasn't been changed. You can, as part of the thing you hand into a cryptographic hash, you can hand this key. Well, when the guy at the other end looks at the message, he also puts in the key. The hashes match, nobody's changed your message. Nobody's changed your message and it came from you. If you were to sign something, Josh talked about signing. Signing means apply the decrypt operation, which is the operation in an asymmetric cipher that uses the private key. If you sign something by encrypting it, anybody can confirm that you did that, right? Because they can apply the public encryption function, which undoes the decryption, and the thing makes sense. If you want to sign a long data stream, like you want to say, here's a huge program, I guarantee this came from Microsoft. What you do is you do a hash, a cryptographic hash of the whole thing. You get 160-bit quantity, and you encrypt it by applying the private key, which is actually called decryption in the public key case. That's a digital signature. And if I give you a certificate that names a hash in a digital signature, you can guarantee that it came from the guy who held the private key. Anybody can... You probably did something better. Anybody can confirm that it came from me, and nobody but me can make the statement accurately. Okay. Another set of applications is a cryptographic hash without anything else can securely identify bit streams like programs. So you don't need SIDs for programs. Cryptographic hash is a perfectly good identifier for a program. Because if you change one lousy bit of the program, the cryptographic hash is going to give you a different value. And it's going to be hard for anybody to fake you out on that one. Like, you know, change it intelligently. Entropy mixing. Because of this property where a small change spreads out, it's good for entropy mixing. Where you, entropy mixing is you've got a big pool of entropy, random data, and you want to mix it up so So it's a good source for a uniformly distributed n-bit input to a, you know, a key, basically. So it's good for that. Password protection. So here's a nice, interesting application that was used historically. You know, one thing you could do when somebody types in their username and password is you could store the password in the database. The trouble is, if somebody steals the disk, they got all the passwords. They're in the clear. They're on the disk there. But instead of doing that, you don't store the password. You store a cryptographic hash of the password. Well, now stealing the disk for that doesn't do you too much good. In fact, you want to do something a little bit more. You want to solve the password. But the basic idea is knowing the hash of the password doesn't tell me the password. And again, many of the protocols that use bit commitment, and Josh talked about bit commitment last week, can use cryptographic hashes. That's another application. You can actually do cryptographic hashes based on mathematical functions. And a classic example is, I'll not try to pronounce their names, this. And so the basic mechanism is, suppose you have a big prime P, and P minus 1 divided by 2 is also a prime. And you have, again, we haven't done a lot of field arithmetic and finite field, so this doesn't make sense. It's okay. Suppose you have a primitive root in F sub P. Primitive root means a function so that a squared, a cubed, all that generates the multiplicative group. That's the whole multiplicative group. Okay, you can define a cryptographic hash using this primitive. You pick a random B, you raise A to some this S power and B to the T power. And I want to show you that, I would want to show you if I had more time, that being able to solve, to produce this, to undo the one-wayness of this function would be equivalent to solving the discrete log problem. I did a proof here. I'm not going to do it. So the basic idea is if this function were really not one-way, in other words, you could find a preimage, then you could solve the discrete log problem. And that's believed to be hard. Nobody's done that. Okay. But it's way too slow. For the reasons I told you originally, for the non-symmetric. So typically, the standard construction people use is called the Merkle-Damgaard, and I'm probably mispronouncing that construction. And basically, I'll look at it for DES. You have a compression function. You have an initial vector. You have 160 bits of state, which is 532-bit words. And actually, unlike DES, Indianness actually counts here because you do use values as words, not bytes. And a compression function takes a 512-bit input and changes the 160 bits of state, which eventually will become the hash. And in fact, it does it in a multi-round transformation, 80 for SHA. And then you keep doing this with successive 512-bit bytes until you're done with all the data. You usually pad the data. I won't talk too much about padding, but usually pad it by appending a 1 and the size of the thing you hashed. It's called MD strengthening. And then you output it through another function. So then you take this 160 bits of the final round and you apply another function to it. And that's the hash. It has a very similar structure to DES. Here's the round transformation for SHA in just schematically. We're going to go with SHA-1 in a great deal of detail. Again, we have the function F, and it's an ugly function. In fact, it's three ugly functions for SHA-1. You have a set of constants, and then you have expanded rounds of the 160-bit input. And what this basically means is the output of one round takes the first word and sticks it in the second word. It takes the first word, shifts it over five letters, and adds it to this thing. And again, which gets added to F, which gets added to this, which gets added to that, which gets stuck in the first thing. And there are actually 80 rounds of this in SHA-1. So a very, very, very similar mechanism to the cryptographic hash. I actually am not going to go through padding, but I will explain just two more things, and then I'll let you go. First of all is a birthday attack. Yes?
So you were saying earlier that just showing two messages that produce the same result is sufficient to say that it's broken.
It's bad. You betcha.
So for the confidence games, because we don't sort of have formal proofs on these sorts of things, they're all sort of our gut feeling. If someone can show two messages that have the same hash value,
as far as the cryptographic key is concerned, that hash function is now suspect.
Yeah, I mean, isn't it like impossible? I mean, that's always going to be the case that you have more than one message that.
But, yeah, but finding, defining
producing
it, right?
Is the trick.
I mean, it takes something like SHA-1. Your random birth card that you could store 2-to-the-80 hashes. Yeah, after doing 2-to-the-80 work, generating 2-to-the-80 random inputs, you'd likely find one collision. 2-to-the-80 is a lot of work.
That's a lot, yeah. Which is I'm just about to say. For cryptographic hashes, remember there are two things, two problems. The one-wayness. So for an n-bit hash, you would expect it to take on the order of 2-to-the-n to break the one-wayness. For any function, no matter what you do, if you can exhaustively go through all the 2-to-the-n values, you're going to find, you know, you're an invertible. You're going to find something that maps to it. But for collision, you, even in theory, no matter how good the hash is, you can always do better. It's called a birthday attack. And the way this is normally presented in the math class is, you know, you have a class of more than 23 students, and you say to them, you know, I'll bet $5 at least two of you have the same birthday. And everybody looks around and says, you have to be crazy for that bet. And it turns out, since 23 is about the square root of 365, the probability is 0.5 or higher that two of you guys are going to have a birthday. In fact, in this size class, it's practically guaranteed, you know, practically printing money to do that. but again, so cryptographic hashes you can do no better in preventing cryptographic collisions than the square root of the number of outputs, which means you divide the exponent by 2. So for a 160-bit cryptographic hash, you expect to see a collision after 2-to-the-80th hashes.
Which is still a lot.
Which is a whole lot. And it's the birthday problem. Again, if you want to calculate it right, to pick independent quantities, right? So to pick independent values for the output hash, you have n ways to pick the first one, n minus one ways to pick the second one, n minus two ways to pick the third one, and so on. The number of ways to produce the thing is n, n, n. And when this ratio falls, you get a collision. It gets small off. This is the way of a non-colliding thing, and so you have to subtract it from 1 to get it. Okay, so now you know everything you need to know for Brian to tell you about protocols. Thank you. I'm sorry I went over a little bit.
John, one tiny bit of housekeeping I want to take care of. I've got a pile of assignments here, and you've got a pile of assignments there. We will put things together with things that have been emailed to us. We'll get them graded. The intent is to get them back to you quickly next week, hopefully, and do that periodically. But the question is where to return them. So I think the default assumption is we'll keep track of where we got them, and unless you tell us otherwise by email, we'll return them to the site where we collected them. And those of you who sent us stuff by email, we will presumably print and make comments on in some way. Let us know where you want us to give you the comments. It's not by email.
That's good. Thank you. Again, one final thing. You have 5 homework problems, but 1 is extra credit. I didn't cover the rotors. If you're really aggressive, you can do the rotor problem. But there are 4 problems. First problem is encrypt something using a big vinaigrette cipher. And as part of the problem, you're going to do an index of coincidence against columns and something and learn something. You're going to decrypt something. This will be exciting. I give you a message. I haven't told you anything about the message except it's encoded with a certain number of direct standard alphabets, just like I showed you. You're going to break it. And you're going to break it by determining the number of alphabets, picking out the most probable letters, and decrypting them. Then you're going to do a calculation that calculates the uncertainty or entropy in a message, a plain text thing, and a ciphertext, and find out how much information is disclosed by giving you a piece of plain text and ciphertext. And finally, for the non-extra credit, you will do 2 rounds of DES, and I think I've given you enough data so you don't have to do too much work. You really just have to do the 2 rounds. And then finally, there's an extra credit assignment that will basically ask you to encrypt something with a single rotor machine, which, as I said somebody before the class started, was the first encryption algorithm in Unix. The first encrypt in Unix was a single rotor machine. Thank you all very much.